with someone for 2 weeks, you find out a lot about them.
Call the House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development to order. Welcome, everyone, and welcome my new co-chair. Welcome my new vice chair. Today, folks, we're going to do a short adoption of committee rules first. So with that, I'm going to open an organizational meeting and draw one's attention to the organizational rules. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the House Interim Committee on Transportation Economic Development Committee rules. I'm not seeing a date, so these are the proposed rules. They're probably the only ones.
Motion to adopt the House Interim Committee on Transportation Economic Development Committee rules. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. I will close the organizational meeting and open an informational meeting. I want to welcome the four economists that joined us today, and I want to thank each of you for coming here today and sharing your time and experience with us. And of course, we're looking forward to hearing solutions to the economic malaise that has settled across the nation, reflected in today's stock market, which I hope isn't some sort of anticipatory move in anticipation of your testimony. So with that, we're going to hear from Dr. Warner first. And the idea here is that by the end of this exercise, each of you are going to take about 15 minutes to make a presentation, and then while the four of you come up, we'll ask questions. It may be that we should allow you to complete your presentation, and if someone has some questions of each, we might ask them at the end of your presentation, but not for too long, so that when we get done, we can ask all of you questions. So with that, Dr. Warner, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Paul Warner of the Legislative Revenue Office, and I had the shortest distance of any of the panel to come across the hall. So thank you for inviting me. What I'd like to do is go through some of the fundamental forces we see that I think are really affecting our state economy. Not so much that there are things that you can resolve as a policymaker because they're global in nature, but you're dealing with the consequences, and I think they're very much things that are affecting our policy here in Oregon and really the lives of your constituents. So there are three things that I've identified here that are driving the U.S. and the world economy. The first is what I'm calling a balance sheet recession and recovery. This started in December of 2007. It was the longest recession we've had since 29-33. Our recovery's been very weak. Historically, we've had weak recoveries following these balance sheet or financial sector-driven recessions, and now we appear to be very close to entering another recession as the economy has slowed. So we're in this period of adjusting to a number of fundamental imbalances that developed over the last 25 years, and I have a slide showing what those are. There's been a major geographic shift in the world economic order, where what's driving the world economy. I think that has major implications for us in Oregon. And finally, there's a shift going on in what's driving U.S. economic growth, what there is of it, and what we expect to drive growth over the next 10 years or so, compared to what we've seen over the last 20 years. This slide I made up some time ago during the recession, but I still think it's the best way to capture the imbalances that grew over, you can see, essentially a 27-year period in which the amount of the economy that could be was committed to consumption, consumer spending, and housing jumped from 67% to 75% over that extended period. That's a huge jump in the amount of resources that are being driven by housing and consumption. So those are largely domestic sectors that were driving growth in the economy. And what was used to finance that shift was a sharp drop in household savings. from around a historical average of 8 to 10% down to some quarters where we actually had negative savings leading up to the recession that started in December of 2007. And the corollary to that is that household debt was building up, and you can see basically a doubling of that household debt over that 27-year period as consumers were running up debt in order to finance housing and consumer spending. And also in that process, an imbalance developed in our foreign trade, which was essentially balanced in 1980. And by 2007, we had a huge, by any comparative standards, a huge net trade imbalance of 6% of GDP. So these are huge shifts that were going on within the economy, and they created these imbalances. Of course, the other side of this equation was, well, how was this being financed? It was being financed by borrowing from overseas. A lot of it from China, from Asia, and from those countries that were saving more than, that were consuming less than what they were producing. And they were, of course, also exporting into this market for American consumers. So those imbalances, what we're seeing right now is an adjustment to those imbalances. For example, the saving rate has risen into the 4 to 6% range. Household debt has dropped below 120%. And we've seen some gains on net exports. So those things are being corrected. The problem is it's a long, slow, painful process to go through, and we're pretty much in the middle of that process now. The other shift that's going on in terms of that, in terms of the world economy, and there was an article in The Economist last week, and I made a chart from that. I thought it was interesting because it gives you a very long-term look at where the center of economic power has been historically. Of course, going back to 1870, it was the European countries with Britain as the, playing the dominant role. By the post-war period, 1973, the U.S. economy, you can see that the U.S. economy was more than constitutes a higher percentage of the world economy than the next two largest economies combined, much as Britain had done in 1870. By 2010, we're in a period now where there is a lot more balance between the top two countries, with Japan sliding due primarily to demographics. And by 2030, these projections that were in the article in The Economist have China at 18% of the world economy, and the U.S. down about 10.1%. The share is measured here as a combination of share of world GDP primarily, but also trade and capital flows. So you can see where that shift is going. The other thing that's interesting about 2030 is notice that China would be at a dominant role similar to what the U.S. was in 1973 and similar to what Great Britain was in 1870. Now, keep in mind, though, this doesn't mean that China is going to be richer than the U.S. This is just percentage of the world economy, and there's about four times as many Chinese as there are Americans. So on a per capita basis, we're not talking about China becoming better off than the U.S. We're just talking about their overall economy taking up a bigger share of the total. So as we look to the U.S. economy and these imbalances that have grown, look at what might be driving the U.S. economy as we look ahead over the, for the next 10 years or so. Well, those of you who fondly recall the principles of macroeconomics and the kind of the ABCs of that, looking at the components of demand, consumption, housing I've broken out, business investment, government spending, and then a netting of exports and imports into the economy. Well, in fact, this quote came from Robert Solow, who's probably best known for his work on growth theory over the years. But looking at those components, Solow's conclusion is that consumer spending will not be as strong a driving force as it had been in the past. I think if my daughter was here, she'd probably say, well, duh. Because we're not going to be able to sustain the kind of consumer spending we've had over the last several decades because the debt simply won't be there to finance it. Government spending, and we've seen this kind of play out here over the last last couple of years, government spending is limited by the amount of debt financing that either the bond markets so far have not really punish the government for borrowing so much because interest rates are so low, yet we're seeing kind of the political response to that with a lot of pressure at the federal level.
Can you pause for just a second, Mr.
Chair? Yeah, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not seeing the handout of this presentation. If it's been given to me, I'm just missing it. Could you go back two slides, maybe just one slide? I want to see the U.S. I think 13.2, China 12.6. I'm trying to take notes. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. in terms of current 2013-3, 12-3, and Japan 6-9. Thank you.
Okay.
Paul, is there a way that we could have copies of your presentation when we're done?
Okay. Absolutely.
That would, yes. That would be great. Okay.
I'm sorry. They were
provided to you electronically, Mr. Chair.
Oh,
no.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So what that leaves, and this is the following up on the quote from Robert Solow, is leaves the two sources of expenditure growth as net exports, which one of that component netting out exports and imports, and business investment. And in fact, there's another, this quote was from about early stages of the recovery. Very similar quote in the Wall Street Journal this week from Glenn Hubbard, basically arguing the same thing, that it's going to have to be exports and business investment that are going to drive economic growth in the U.S. in order to restore the imbalances that have happened. There's some limitations there, and I'll talk about that in a minute. In terms of the fundamentals of the Oregon economy and what this means for us in Oregon, I've always thought one of the helpful visions to have of Oregon is to recognize that we are largely a goods-producing state, goods and distribution-oriented state. We are in the middle of some very large markets to the north of us in the Puget Sound area, on up into British Columbia, of course, to the south of us into the Bay Area, and then the link to the Asian markets where a large portion of the world's population lives. So we're kind of goods-oriented, and those markets are all at relative proximity to us. We have developed a large export sector, and I'll show you those numbers in a minute. And we are attractive to in-migrants. We've consistently gotten net in-migration, although overall mobility has slowed considerably. Still, Oregon is in a net gain position. And I'll say a little bit, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to say something about the tax structure, so I'll put that in there as well. And those of you on the Revenue Committee, I know I've seen these slides many times. This looks at the Oregon and U.S. economies. These numbers are for 2010. These are a little different numbers than you typically see from the state economists in the projections, because those are based on employment. These are gross state product numbers. They're value added by sector. And a couple of things that stand out when you look at Oregon's economy relative to the U.S. about what sectors are relatively large and what sectors are relatively small. The first is, even though it's quite small overall, agriculture in Oregon is about double what it is for the U.S. and its relative share of the economy. Although ag has declined over the years, it remains relatively important as a export-related sector. The next sector that really stands out is durable goods manufacturing. You can see the percentage in Oregon for value-added and durable goods manufacturing is 19.4%, about a fifth of the Oregon economy. For the U.S. economy as a whole, it's 6.6%. And then if you add these two, durables and non-durables, you've got still Oregon is almost three times the U.S. proportion. So we're largely a manufacturing-driven economy, particularly durable goods manufacturing. Computer and electronic equipment makes up about 70% of that. So that's a big part of where our value added is. If you look at the sectors where we're relatively small, finance is one. And again, this has to do with being a goods-producing state. The financial centers are around us in the Bay Area and Seattle. And you can see that finance is about 18% of the Oregon economy versus 21% overall for the U.S. One of the things that actually helped us muddle through the financial meltdown a little bit. And the other is professional technical information, the services, the service end of it, not the manufacturing end of it. You can see we're about two-thirds relative proportion of the U.S. with 8% in that sector. When we look at exports, and the sensitivity of the Oregon economy to exports. These are 2010 data, taking that gross state product number, dividing it by the latest, the annual data for 2010 on exports. One thing that's interesting to me, if you look at exports, you don't really see any kind of real regional pattern. And you don't even see necessarily being coastal states. Some of the states that are relatively sensitive to exporting are Utah, Kentucky, Indiana, Tennessee. They're not coastal states, but yet they built strong export sectors.
Cliff.
Representative.
Thank you.
Just going, you don't need to go back, but you said that our durable goods manufactured or manufactured durable goods are about 19%. That's our highest. What's the forecast on that? Because I'm assuming more manufacturing is being exported daily.
The expectation, Representative Lindsay, is that manufacturing will grow in terms of value added as exports pick up, as we do see some signs of recovery. So we would anticipate growth in that sector. One of the issues around manufacturing is that you do get a different story when you look at value added versus employment. And so we've seen a lot of gains in manufacturing because of increased productivity. And that's been key to being competitive, but we haven't seen real strong job growth. And we'd expect that to continue into the future. So it'll be driving our economy, but it's not going to directly be driving a lot of jobs.
And then quick follow-up. Going back to you mentioned Hubbard came out with a report, I think, last week, talking about we need to rely on exports. Does he, well, maybe you can just point me to the article or something or his report, but does he drill down a little bit further on how we should do those exports or...
Representative Lindsay, this was a Wall Street Journal quote, like one paragraph.
Oh, but, okay. All right.
You know, I think he has some particular views on how we should change the structure. But
okay. Representative Nathanson and members of the committee, it's perfectly okay that questions be asked during the presentations. It's just that we need to keep an eye on our time, since we were allocating 15 minutes to each economist. And it's optimistic that they'll actually stay within that period of time. If we ask lots of questions, they won't. So, Representative Nathanson, go ahead.
Thank you. This isn't durable goods, but when I think about value-added food processing as part of export, where does that count in all of this stuff?
Representative Nathanson, food processing is non-durable goods.
Right.
So it is. We do have a relatively smaller share, you can see in that, but it is the largest component of that 2.8%, the non-durable.
Representative Smith, did you have a question?
Yeah, thanks. You might try a short answer and then also think about it. We can talk about it after. But to me, a essential question sort of underpinning or overall, you know, overpinning all of this stuff is what's the best line of business where we're going to be and the best lines of business? And what, if anything, can our meager chairs do to impact that or, you know, our not-so-meager chairs? And so on these, do we have... anywhere sort of cross-referenced with, like on that other, on the next slide, with the growth of each of these states in living wage, you know, living wage job growth over the last, you know, over a certain period, and so we can kind of do a quick comparison and say, oh yeah, actually exports are one of the best indicators of living wage job growth, or maybe it's something else, and maybe that's another part of the presentation, but that's the big question in my head, and then a related question.
Representative Smith, one comment I would make about kind of looking empirically at what's happened, I would argue that our reliance on exports are one of the reasons why we've been an underperformer in the last 10 years because of that trade imbalance that's grown. So I think you have to look at periods where we've seen export growth to get at that, but that's something we could certainly look at, yeah.
Thanks.
And I will try to address some of the policy issues here at the end and as a lead-in for the other panelists. Another characteristic of Oregon's economy that we've been well aware of, with the exception of the out-migration in the early 80s, Oregon has been a destination state. People want to move to Oregon. You see the drop-off in 2010, but that's largely due to a slowdown in overall mobility. People can't sell their houses in the recession, and we've seen very little movement. We expect that to come back. This is the September economic forecast, and you can see we expect that to come back and to have net in-migration in the neighborhood of 30,000 to 40,000 a year. So we're going to have an influx of people into the state, and that will generate jobs in and of itself, but it will also provide some public sector issues around providing services, dealing with the kind of transportation issues you have to deal with. One thing I will say about this particular measure of net migration, the best predictor is not necessarily our unemployment rate, but our unemployment rate compared to California's. And even though ours has gone way up, California's has stayed ahead of us. And only when we get those periods such as the early 80s, when we had a defense boom in California, do we get that net out migration. Well, this is my favorite slide on the revenue structure from the census data. And just a couple points I wanted to make here. One is that we are less dependent on taxes than the typical state, about 46% of our overall revenue, our general revenue, which would exclude enterprises and pensions, for example. And also, we are more reliant on the federal government, which is a negative for us going forward, I think. Our charges, service fees, and so forth are higher, and our miscellaneous is higher because of lottery, which is in that miscellaneous category. And, of course, our tax system itself is very unique. And one of the unique features of our tax system actually lowers our numbers here in 07, 08 because it was our last kicker period, which actually lowered our income taxes, which typically rank in the fourth to fifth range. But you can see that overall our tax burden is relatively low. Again, it's somewhat lower because of the kicker. Normally, we're in the high 30s by this measure. The corporate income tax is about average. Property taxes are average. Where we really stand out in the mix of our taxes is our general sales tax is tied for the bottom, of course, with the other states that don't have one. But also, our selective sales tax ranks right at the bottom of the states. So if you combine those two consumption-based taxes, Oregon has the lowest consumption tax burden in the country relative to other states, and of course one of the highest income tax burdens. If you look at kind of the shares of the Oregon economy and what we've seen happen historically, if we think about what's happened in the world economy, in the U.S. economy, there's probably not a lot of things you can do as policymakers to change those trends in the U.S. economy. But what you can do, I think, over time, particularly if we're looking out longer term over 10 years, the lines we have there, the green line, the share of Oregon's economy relative to the U.S., which is about 1.15%, so I've multiplied it by 100, and the per capita income, those are the things in the long term that you probably can influence through good policies by making Oregon more competitive and attracting more labor and capital relative to other states. You can see that our forecasters are somewhat optimistic that we're going to gain some ground over the next 5 years relative to the U.S., and that's due to the drivers in the U.S. economy. Exports and business capital investment are going to be a plus for us and help us gain some ground. Little less so on the per capita side, which what that means is some of this growth is obviously going to be driven by net in-migration. We're going to have more people in the state. So on a per capita basis, we're going to gain less ground. You can see the rides we've taken historically, and we could go into those reasons, but I'll pass on that because of time. So if we look at kind of these fundamental trends, these are the things I would draw from them and suggest you think about. There's nothing you can do about the imbalances that the balance sheet recession we're going through. It's something we're going to have to live through. And, I think as a policymaker, what you need to do is try to position the state as best you can for those changes. I do think that we are, and the operative word here is relative, we are relatively well positioned. And, I think we're going to gain ground relative to the U.S. because of those fundamental forces out there. Even though you have a stagnant U.S. economy, we'll be gaining some ground. I think it is important to keep in mind that shifts toward exports and business investment, they'll stimulate growth, the value-added growth, but they won't replace the jobs we've lost in construction and the financial service sector. And so the consequence of that is we're going to be dealing with surplus labor for a while, and that's going to be a very difficult policy issue for you. The shifts in global economic power. We saw the projections on China. My sense of that, historically, if you look at those kinds of shifts, I think they're associated with more volatility. So even if we have lower trend growth, it doesn't mean we have less volatility. I think we'll have more volatility, and we're seeing that now over the last 5 years, and I think that'll continue. So what that means in terms of our public finance structure is we're, because of our economy, our reliance on durable goods manufacturing, and because of our tax structure, we're going to be experiencing a lot of volatility in our public finances. So the policy challenges ahead. Well, as I mentioned, there's going to be extended period of historically high unemployment. That's going to be a major challenge. The improving of Oregon's competitiveness, improving our position relative to other states, means increasing the productivity of our labor force. and it means ensuring that the state attracts labor and capital, managing the unstable public finances, and then trying to build on those competitive advantages. I think the policy areas to focus on for the, to meet these challenges in terms of dealing with unemployment and dealing with productivity of the labor force, it's education and training. Those are the things that, that will work over time. They don't work quickly, but they are things that over time that, that will work. So resources committed to training and education will help with that issue. In terms of the attracting capital, a tax system that is more destination-based will be more attractive to capital. So by destination-based, I mean more consumption-based and less source-based, which is an income tax system, is a source-based tax where you're taxing the factors of production. So a shift toward a more destination-based tax system, our economic models show, do generate net economic growth for the state and position us better. Now, there's trade-offs. There's trade-off in terms of equity when you do shift to consumption taxes, and those are things you'd have to deal with, wrestle with before making those kinds of steps. In terms of the unstable public finances, I think the and in terms of making the state attractive to labor and capital, the best thing to do is have a consistent set of policies, a consistent budgetary policy. Well, how do you do that with an unstable public finances? Well, the key to that is a strong reserve fund policy, so that you have reserves built up during the periods where we do have some relatively strong growth, so you're able to stabilize some of the fluctuations that occur as a result of our the structure of our economy, the changes the world economy is going through, so that you can provide more stability and more certainty in terms of the provision of those services. So those would be my suggestions.
Thank you very much, Paul. The last slide presents lots of opportunities for questions, but we're going to move on to the next presenter and give him a chance to share his thoughts, then, and hopefully we'll have time at the end for questions, because I know we have a bunch. Okay. So with that, thank you, and let's move to Dr. Patowski. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if this first slide is going to involve a kayak and a...
<That's> possible.
No, I left the kayak out.
Okay. Good afternoon, members of the House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Good morning, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, co-vice chairs, and all others that are here. For the record, my name is Tom Patowski. I'm now at Portland State University, wearing two hats, chair of the Economics Department, and also director of a new research center, the Northwest Institute for Applied Economic Research. So with that, some of the comments I have today are going to be very similar to what you just saw from Paul, and it's not true that all economists disagree. We actually do look at things in relatively the same kind of tools. Of course, we may come out with different recommendations by using those tools. But let me just start off by pointing out here that Oregon has definitely grown over time. Our employment in back just after World War II was about 1% of what the U.S. employment is. That's moved up. You can see that these shaded areas are recessions that happened over time. And you can see that drop in our proportion happened late 70s, early 1980s. And, of course, I've said this before, this was our great recession in Oregon. The U.S. has had its great recession, which is the recession we're just getting out of. And Oregon also got hit horribly by that, but really the time that we really got hit was the early 80s. But we've come back from that, and now we're sitting at about 1.2% of the overall employment relative to the U.S. Now, this next slide takes that sort of 1.2% rule across many areas. If we look at employment, we look at population, you look at our gross domestic product at the state level relative to gross domestic product for the U.S., our exports, personal income, you kind of get this sense, and this is a very rough rule of thumb across all sorts of measures, we're about 1.2% of what the U.S. does. Now, what's important about this is that if you think you can do something to change the fortunes of Oregon within, say, the next 6 months, you're fighting a headwind here where you're about 1.2% of the whole U.S. economy. And so likely you're not going to be able to make much a dent in any trends in a short period of time. Similar to what Paul was showing, although my charts are much more prettier than his, we have a changing mix of industries. As you can see here, we're comparing Oregon in 2000, 2010. 2000 was just sort of peaking out, coming into recession. 2010, we're trying to move our way out of recession. But you can see some of the changes. Even though we had a huge growth in the computer electronics industry in 1990s, you can see the proportion actually increased quite a bit into 2010. And so as Paul was showing you that durable manufacturing and how that's a larger percent of Oregon's economy compared to what it is overall in the U.S., a good chunk of that really is related to the computer electronics industry. And so we have an advantage in that area and in some sense a disadvantage because once you tie yourself a little bit too much to one area, you sometimes are then more vulnerable to how that area moves. But if you take a look at some of these areas, you can see construction and real estate, where the percentage proportions down a little bit, and that's really an indication of the huge housing meltdown that we had. We look at retail and trade, hospitality services are down a little bit. I think that's also the retrenched households being a little more conservative on their spending. Government, interestingly enough, not much of a change from 2000, 2010. Generally, government's proportion will tend to be a little larger as you're in recessionary periods compared to the rest of the economy before the private economy starts to come up. So it'll bounce around along those areas. So let's take a look at comparing to the U.S., and Paul showed you this graph also, and this is just a different way of looking at it. Once again, government here is exactly the same to the U.S. average, and it was the same in Paul's chart. He had a slightly different percentage, but the percentages were the same. But the computer electronics is really the telling one here on the left-hand side. You can see above for the U.S., it's about 1.4% of overall. For us, of our output, it's 13.7%, and that's quite a multiple more than what we see for the U.S. Other areas kind of interesting are professional, technical services, management, information, private education, very service type oriented, is less than the U.S. Our health care is a little bit higher, about the same in wholesale trade. And then we're a bit lower in the finance and insurance. And as Paul said, that might have been somewhat of a saving grace for us, given that other parts of the country really got hit in that area. Now, this one just simply takes those percentages, and what's called location quotient is to say, well, if computer electronics products is 1.3% for the U.S., is it a similar percentage for Oregon? And what we see in this top line is that no, relative to what the computer electronics is for the U.S., what it is for Oregon to the U.S., it's about 9.8 times that level. And so we definitely have a predominance compared to the U.S. in computer electronics. All the other ones down here are a little different. Our government in 2010 is about the same as the U.S., as I said. It had been a little above in 2000. Retail trade, hospitality, also a little lower than what the percentage is for the U.S. So all these have come down a little bit. The real one that's jumped up quite dramatically from 2000. We've got healthcare is a higher percentage now for us relative to the U.S., and then of course the computer electronic products. So that's kind of just structure of what you deal with in this economy. Now, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to pull off of some work that's been done by the Oregon Employment Department. And they have a great series going on the green sectors that are out here. And these are just a list of all sorts of green sectors that they've been looking at in terms of job definitions. And so I'm just put this is, and we, I'm sorry to say that you don't have a handout with you. We'll correct that and get a handout to you before the end of the day. But these green jobs, the study has found some interesting results. For example, they were comparing the fourth quarter 2005 to the fourth quarter 2010. And they said five of these seven green sectors studied experienced covered employment gains. The type of data that they had available was those workers that are covered by insurance. But notice the state overall in this period lost 4.5%. So here's a sector that managed five of those seven areas that actually added some employment. And then also they've one of the other findings is that with hourly wages that are $20 or more exceeded the rate of all sectors statewide by at least 10 percentage points, some as 49 percentage points. And some of these sectors also, they need skilled labor, they tend to have higher wages. Other work that I've done with a colleague of mine at Portland State University, we're found that really through this recession, your green sector jobs tended to do a little better. They weren't hit quite as hard. The place that did get hit hard was the place that everybody else got hit hard, anything really connected with housing. So those green jobs that were involved in the construction area, they also got hit. But percentage-wise, not quite hit as hard as overall sector did. So that's just an aspect of saying, you know, where is it a possible area to take a look at in terms of possible putting investments in your economy? Now, Patrick sent an email to us, and these were three questions that he sent. You know, how can Oregon make itself more attractive to economic and employment growth, capital investment? What's Oregon doing wrong that other states are doing right? Does Oregon do right, would, at least better than some other states? You know, if you could do, if you'd be king for a day, what would you do to affect the legislation to make these changes? Now, these are the questions you're asking. And my colleagues, of course, are saying, oh, Tom, you're nuts. You shouldn't have brought this up because who has the exact answers to these questions? So let me start with this. First of all, no one's hiding what the answers are. But you want to beware of those that know the exact answers to these questions. And what I mean by that is that if you have someone coming along and saying, well, you know, I know the answers to these because it's a right to work state. If you were, you know, right to work state, you know, you would have economic growth. If you didn't have a minimum wage tax, it would be economic growth. If you didn't have environmental regulations, you'd have economic growth. If you're a red state instead of a blue state, you'd have economic growth. The list goes on, and you want to beware of people that know exactly what the answer is, but what they're really doing is pushing their political agenda and not really answering the question. It's a night because these questions are so complex that the ready answer isn't there. If we had a recipe as to how to create economic growth and to bring in capital and be in nirvana, that cake would have been baked long ago. So let's take a look at some generalities that I think are trying to answer some of these questions. First, states perform poorly in bad economic times. There's really, and when you're about 1.2% of the activity, it's tough for you to do anything in a short period of time. Business location decisions are complex and at times unique. The literature is full of aspects where it was because that's where they went on vacation as a kid, and so they moved the company there, are the type of aspects. But there's also, even though they're complex, there's also other reasons that I'm going to go into that actually do matter. Environmental regulation, taxes, land use laws, they do influence business decisions, but given the level that they're at right now, they're likely not the tipping points that cause a business to locate someplace or the other. You could have, say, Wyoming, not have any sort of regulations, not have any taxes, any of that, and I really doubt you would see people beating a path to build their businesses and take them to Wyoming. And there's something else that needs to be there, either with infrastructure, your population base, transportation, other things have to be available. But, like I said, these things can matter. They can be put to an extreme where they do hurt business decisions in the sense that businesses won't want to locate in your state. But I don't think any of these are at the point right now where they would be such a point where they would cause that kind of a stress. Tax breaks on capital investments, they tend to have the most influence. You look at this at the national level. If, for example, your own experience, I think, with the Betsy's, Business Energy Tax Credit, you make it attractive enough, and it does create things. So I think if you're looking at legislation in an area, this may be one of the more fruitful areas to look into to attract capital investments. Environments that foster an entrepreneurial spirit have better chances for economic vitality. And that's easy to say, but how do you make that descriptive? What's the formula for doing this? Edward Glaser, in his book, The Triumph of Cities, you know, this is one of his aspects that he says, when he compares cities, which ones are more economic vitality, which ones are dying off, he likens this as one aspect that is important. And we can take a look around. You can look at Silicon Valley, so on and so forth, around the country, of where this is probably true. Leverage, possibly through legislation, what are you good at? What are your core competencies? And Paul also mentioned this. You know, what do we do good here? And it's from every place, from our computer electronics industry, which is very important. And I don't want to leave out the industry and upset someone that I didn't mention their favorite area. We have a great places for vacation opportunities, for example, because of the great weather, the great landscape. We also are known as the green state. Is there a way that can be leveraged further? And then till your soil before you plant. And I don't mean this in the economic development sense of industrial parks, that sort of field of dreams idea where build and they will come. I mean this that to be able to, in the future, you can't do anything in the first 6 months, but down the road, if you can change your infrastructure, have the transportation, bridges, things like that are helpful. Your workforce is skilled. Education is strong. These are things that are going to help other businesses come and business and people here start to plant their businesses here and grow.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I want to ask about the fourth item on there before we leave this slide. To me, it's really important. It's not just parsing words. You've got a statement on there, tax breaks on capital investments tend to have the most influence. The most influence of what? The most influence of other kinds of tax breaks, the most influence of other kinds of government actions, or the most influence of all the factors, including adequacy of access to workforce, access to good transportation hubs. So the most influence compared to what's set.
Yes, Representative Nathanson. I mean this in the sense that it makes the incentive for people to want to make these initial new capital investments in the sense that if, for example, if we had an electric car manufacturer, if there was a tax incentive there to build the plant, the capital, the physical items, and then once that happens, other things follow. That means increased workforce. It helps the tax base eventually. So those things start to come in. And actually, I like your question really a lot because, you know, you open this up even further. And I maybe, when I said capital investments, you know, I may have added capital human investment. The knowledge base, the people's trainings and skills, because that's capital human investment, and there are returns on that. Now, it's loose foot. You know, you train a person, and we don't have slavery here. There's not a contract that they got to work in Oregon. They can go someplace else. And some people also believe that we can import our skilled people in, and we don't need to train them here. It's a tough game to play, because what you want also is what attracts the skilled people. They also, if they are going to live here and work here, they would like their kids to be able to have the skills and so on by living here. Mm-hmm. So I think you need to still have that skill base coming.
Okay.
And I hope that answers.
Thank you. It's helpful.
And I believe this is my last slide. Just keep in
time. Perfect timing. Thank you very much. And so we have two more economists to go. I'll call up Joe Courtwright.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There. That's it. For the record, I'm Joe Courtwright. I'm an economist with Impresa in Portland, Oregon, and I also serve as the chair of the Governor's Council on Economic Advisors. And I cover the same topics as my colleagues, and hopefully not duplicate what they say, but add some other information.
They've been a little short on, you know, answers, so if you want to state them, feel free to do so.
I'll see what I can do. I'll let you be the judge of that, Mr. Chair. It is helpful to remind ourselves where we are right now, which is we are in the midst of what is the worst national downturn since the Great Depression. It is both longer and deeper than any economic event we've experienced in the last 80 years. So if you are feeling uncomfortable, it is not because of something that the state of Oregon did. It's something that is a national and, in fact, a global event of truly awful proportions. And I won't belabor that, but don't blame yourself and don't blame Oregon for an event that is of a much, much larger scale and consequence. The question is, how are we doing relative to the nation? You've seen a little bit of that. I'll add to it. Again, when the U.S. economy goes down, Oregon's economy goes down. And actually, the record for the last several decades has been, when the U.S. economy is expanding, Oregon's economy expands faster than the nation's. And that should tell you that there's nothing fundamentally wrong with the Oregon economy. During the expansion we've experienced for the last couple of years, we've grown about 1.5% over the last 2 years. U.S. employment is up about 0.9%. So that's a hopeful sign. Unemployment rate is actually Oregon's unemployment rate, which was more than 2 percentage points, almost 3 percentage points above the national average at the bottom of the recession in 2009. We're actually very close to the U.S. average now, within about 0.5 percentage point. And long term, over the last 30 years or so, year in, year out, we average about 1 percentage point higher than the nation. So, you know, relative to where we usually are, relative to the nation, we're doing a little bit better. The question is, you know, when do both of those numbers come down? And what will it take to have a successful economy? That's what you're worried about. And unfortunately, we are in such a deep hole that it doesn't look like we'll come out of this for a long time. This is from the Global Insight forecast, which powers the Oregon economic and revenue forecast. That red line is the 6% unemployment rate. And if you'll notice, if you look backwards in history, back to 1996, and even in fact back to 1990, unemployment stayed below 6% for the two decades, basically of the 90s and the 2000s. It isn't expected to get down nationally below 6% until 2017. So, Mr. Chairman, if you're looking for instant answers, if you're looking for, you know, a hopeful scenario, I'm afraid, you know, once again, we're proving why economics is called the dismal science. It's going to be a tough slide moving forward. So let me talk about what you in Oregon, what we in Oregon can do. And I think the most important advice I would give you is there's almost nothing you can do in the short run. We are along for the ride here. So you have to keep your eye on the long run. What is it you can do to position this state so that over the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, it is in the best possible position that it can be in? Now, sense of history here. Let's step back a little bit. Now, when they built the Capitol building here, they didn't have PowerPoint presentations, perhaps mercifully. They did, however, include icons of the state economy in the building. And you look down at them in the House and Senate chambers all the time. And these were accurate images of the Oregon economy for the first century or so after statehood. We inherited these tremendous forests that provided lots of jobs, provided lumber, fueled the housing industry. We know that agriculture is still an important component of the state's economy, feeds into international trade. All those things are important. But they have shrunk, as you saw from the GSP numbers, the value-added numbers that Tom and Paul presented. They're a much smaller fraction of our economy. And what's taken their place is really these knowledge-based industries, things like high technology and information technology. But even in those resource-based industries, the wood products industry, Representative Nathanson talked about value-added food products, it's not the raw material that drives those industries. It's the innovation. It's the new product development. It's the new ideas that people invent here in Oregon that power those industries forward. So I would argue already, but especially over the next couple of decades, we're in an economy where it's all about being good at creating ideas. We're in a knowledge-based economy. And that's a shift from those patterns woven into the carpets in the House and Senate. So you have to think about the economy in a different way. And I would argue you need to think about and pay particular attention to what I would call the created assets, the clusters of business, the specializations that you heard about, the knowledge base of the state, what our citizens know and are know better than anybody else in the world, the education and talent level of our workforce, and quality of life. And I'll tie those all together. So it's less about the inherited assets that were here at the time of statehood that drive our success. That was true for the first century. It's not so much true now. It now depends on what we build here and, in particular, the knowledge base that we develop here. So what does it take to thrive in this knowledge economy? I work with a national organization called CEOs for Cities that looks at this question for metropolitan areas, but I think the same lessons apply to states. We've done a project we call City Vitals that tries to sketch out what we think places need to do to be successful. And we think there are four critical things that cities, and for that matter states, need to focus on. And they are talent, innovation, connections, and distinctiveness. And I won't have a specific recipe for you here, but what I'll tell you is those are the four ingredients you need to think about in terms of an economic strategy for your place. And I'll go through each of them and describe why they're important and what I think we can do. Let me start with talent, because talent is the most important thing. We know that to be successful in the economy today, you as a worker, or your kids, or your community, or your firm, all have to be well-educated to compete in a global economy and earn high wages. This is what it looked like when I was in high school, basically. There was a stair-step relationship between how much education you had and how much you earned. That staircase has gotten dramatically steeper over the last several decades. You can see, this is how economists do animation. I'll go back and forth here. But you see, it gets steeper and steeper, so that now somebody with a four-year degree earns about 80% more than somebody with a high school degree. Two and a half decades ago, it was about a 40% differential. So all of the gains are coming to people who get a good education. So you've got to pay attention to education. And what is true for individuals, as it turns out, is also true for states. Now, as an economist, we're generally required to stick at least one regression equation in every presentation. This is the one I'll put in this presentation. This shows you the relationship for the 50 United States of the level of education, that's the horizontal axis, that's the percentage of the adults with a four-year degree in the year 2000, and then the per capita income of each of those states in 2010. And what that line shows you is the better educated your population is, the higher your per capita income. In fact, we can explain more than two-thirds of all of the variation in incomes and economic success across states by knowing one thing: what fraction of your adult population has a four-year degree? This should be the most important thing that you think about when you think about economic development. How well educated is your population? Because that is the single biggest determinant of how successful you are. Now, I don't need to say anything about education in this building, because you work on education. It's half the state general fund budget. And you need to invest in education in a variety of ways. And I think I just summarize what I would say is we've been playing defense for a long time in education. We haven't been playing offense. We haven't been trying to do things to make our education dramatically better than other places. And if you see Oregon, we're kind of right about in a little bit to the right of the middle of that chart, basically right in the center of the OR there. But the other thing you need to know about talented people is talented people are extremely mobile, and they have choices. And they do not necessarily need to stay where they are educated. And that's why connections are important, and in particular, place is important. If you look at what drives talent right now, and talented people, is they are choosing to live in places that they like, where they want to live. They have lots of choices. We asked 1,000 recent college graduates, 25 to 34-year-olds, which of these two statements do you most closely identify with? I'm going to follow my career wherever it takes me and where the best job opportunities are, or am I going to choose the place I want to live and pursue my career there? By a 2-to-1 margin, people in this age group told us the second thing, that they're choosing place. And now we've done extensive studies to look and see where well-educated young adults are moving in the United States. And I can tell you they're moving to a few places and away from a lot of others. This is just a quick ranking of metropolitan areas. In the 1990s, the Portland-Vancouver metropolitan area had the fourth fastest rate of growth of talented young adults of any large metropolitan area in the United States. That was a big plus, a big driver, as Tom told you, of economic development. But they're not just moving to metropolitan areas, they're moving to particular places in metropolitan areas. So when you map the increase in young adults in the Portland metropolitan area, that's this chart here, over the last decade, that red circle is a 3-mile circle around Pioneer Courthouse Square. Each of those dots is another 50 people in that age group in that decade. You can see a very strong concentration of well-educated people in the center. So this is sort of, you know, if you watch Portlandia, this kind of puts, this is the economist version of Portlandia. A lot of young people moving to the center of the city. There was about a 30% increase in young adults inside that circle in the 1990s, and about half of the young adults inside that circle had a 4-year degree, which is about double the rates outside that circle. And what's true in Portland is happening now all over the country. We did the same circle exercise for every one of the 50 largest metropolitan areas in the United States over the last decade, since 2000. In close-in neighborhoods, that is when with 3 miles of the center of metropolitan areas, the number of college-educated young adults is increasing 26%, which is twice as fast as it's increasing outside those circles. So the metropolitan areas that are gaining talented young people are places that have great places to live. Now, there are a lot of definitions to that. Clearly, this vibrant urban centers is part of it. Oregon has some other stuff, too, obviously, our tremendous natural resources, climate, recreational opportunities. But paying attention to quality of life is a critical factor for anchoring talented people who have lots of choices about where they want to live. Next thing I'll talk about is, you know, you care about these talented people because they're going to be the ones who come up with new ideas and new businesses. And that's what drives the economy going forward. And it's abundantly clear when we look at Oregon, that's what's been driving our success. You want to know what's underlying that growth in GDP in information communication technology? It's a lot of innovation. This is the number of patents issued to people living in Oregon over basically the last 2 decades. Remember, Tom told you that our share of the national economic activity is about 1.2%. Our share of patenting now is pushing 2.4%. So we're basically punching double our weight in terms of innovation in Oregon. That has been a big driver of growth in our state. So, you know, it's innovation happens in a lot of ways. This is just one of the places we can get data for it. So think about ways that we create new ideas. I'll come back to that. But not only creating new ideas, but creating new businesses. And I appreciate probably from where Representative Nathanson, and this is a Rorschach ink blot diagram. But basically what it shows you is the growth of the high-tech industry in Oregon over the last several decades. The big blue dot is Tektronix. The big pink dot is Intel. All the blue dots are companies that were spun off from, started by former tech employees, similar to the pink dots by Intel. That process of innovation, of entrepreneurship in a cluster drives the growth of the economy. And my colleague who did this chart in 2002 updated it in 2008 and saw further growth. And this is the way, not industrial location, it's growing this kind of cluster that's based on innovation and on talent is what drives economies. And I can show you the same chart for biotechnology in San Diego. I can show you similar charts for other cities in the industries that they are good in. This is the process that you want to make sure is happening in your state and facilitate. Final thing I'll talk about is distinctiveness. Now, I've worked in economic development for 30 years. I staffed the legislature for 12 years. Economic development is an industry of fads and fashions. 20 years ago, everybody wanted to be the next Silicon Valley. 10 years ago, everybody wanted to be the next center of information technology. 5 years ago, it was biotech. Today, it's green and sustainable. Not every place can be best at everything. You have to figure out what your state is best at and pursue that relentlessly. So how do you know what you're good at and how do you build on it? Well, you can look at Oregon. And I'll give you some quotes on this. Michael Porter from Harvard Business School, competitive strategies about being different. Jane Jacobs, the great urbanist, the greatest asset a city can have is something that's different than any other place. So focus on your differences. Well, what's different about Oregon? Well, we have a whole bunch of market data about this. You already know this intuitively as representatives of the people. You probably know this better than I do. In almost every kind of recreational activity that you can talk about, Oregonians are off the chart. We're twice as likely to go camping, 60% more likely to go hiking or backpacking, a lot more likely to golf or hunt. The only thing we're below average in, apparently, is theme park attendance, go figure, and a lot lower level of sedentary lifestyles. Now, aside from bar trivia, of what possible importance could that information be to you? Well, some of you who will remember back to the 1960s, at a time when adult Americans didn't sweat in public if they could avoid it, a bunch of people in Eugene started running and jogging for health. And one of these guys started a company selling Japanese sneakers out of the back of his station wagon. And that company is the largest Fortune 500, one of two Fortune 500 companies in the state. And it comes from that distinctiveness, that being a little bit different and a little bit ahead of what is a national and a global trend. So thinking about, you know, what your unique advantages are, promoting entrepreneurship and encouraging differences is really important. And that's now a really huge cluster. There's Adidas and Nike World Headquarters. So the thing I'll just leave you with is, as you're thinking about this, and as you're sitting in the House and Senate chambers and you glance down at your feet, you see that the emblems of that great historic economy that was here, that we built from the natural resources. Don't give up on that. Don't forget about it. But think about how we add the ideas, the innovation to that, that will be the drivers of income and progress going forward. So I'll just leave you, again, it's about talent, it's about innovation, it's about connections, and it's about distinctiveness. And I'll apologize, Mr. Chairman, if I haven't gotten a lot more specific, but I think having the right framework to think about the question is the most important starting point. It's not about me giving you some prescriptions. It's about you embracing the strategy and thinking about the long run. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. All three presentations thus far have been are just excellent, and we really appreciate the thinking. We don't anticipate specifics. That's up to us to try to draw something out of that which you presented. And as a foundation for moving forward, this is excellent. So thank you very much. And with that, we'll move to our final presenter, Randall. Wait, is there a question? Sorry, Representative.
About patents. I was intrigued about the information about our relatively higher rate of being awarded patents. Can you tell us anything more about that? How many of them are associated with people working for or had recently worked at one of our higher ed institutions? Is it related to higher ed? Because Massachusetts was way off the chart, and you know, on the other diagram. But is it that, or is it just a whole bunch of entrepreneurial and inventive individuals?
You know, actually, where you see patenting basically mirrors our industrial specialization. So we're a big leader in information and communication technology. We're a big leader in footwear technology. We're a big leader in industrial machinery types of patents. And the big driver here has been the growth of the high-tech industry. It tends to overwhelmingly be private sector. The only business where you tend to see a lot of university patents that are numerous tends to be in biotechnology. And we're an also-ran in that industry.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, Randall, is it, how do I pronounce this?
Pazdana. Thank you very much, committee members, co-chairs, and the audience. I've got to find my presentation. Since I'm a Mac user, you know, none of this makes sense to me, but okay, so full screen mode. Black background, which is the black background of the economy that we have in front of us. I'm going to be different in ways that I think you've asked for. I'm going to be very specific about my recommendations, and after I'm done, you'll see why economists don't usually dare to do this, because I will probably offend most of the people in the room and almost certainly all of your constituencies. But I do want to point out, start with one observation, that growth is something that occurs on the margin. Much as the salmon population grows on the margin of the great oceans and small tributaries and rivers, it's on the margin that factors affect economic growth, employment growth, and the growth of an economy. And what I want to talk about briefly is the national policies that we've suffered pose challenges for Oregon, not blaming Oregon for them, identify policy options for Oregon, and try to get some hints from some economic and policy snapshots of Oregon, just numbers, to suggest that these things might be important, and then in the implications, we're going to name policies that you might want to rethink. Oregon is not to blame for the current malaise. Our problems reflect bad national economic policy. The only thing that you guys can do is beat up on our congressional delegation, who can help. You have very smart and important members on that delegation. Basically, from my standpoint, and I am Austrian by descent and Austrian by economic proclivity, there needs to be a significant change in national fiscal and monetary policy. I'm half Austrian and half Scottish, the two cheapest peoples in the world. But also the axis between those two countries, that's where the theory of free market ideas and competition formed, in both of those axes, Austria and Scotland. So my funny last name is an old, ancient Bohemian name. And I don't expect anyone to ever get it right. My mother doesn't even get it right. But I want to say something not positive about Oregon. It's a model of a state that is inherently insensitive to national conditions because of its small size and its limited firm-level diversification. Again, that's nothing that is really our fault. We just happen to be small. And that I've always said that we're a high-beta state. If the national economy hiccups, we fall on the floor. You've seen a slide from one of the other economists that pointed that out. But we are also prone to use policies that reduce economic resilience so that if when we do have a shock, we aren't wrapped in much rubber, we don't have much flexibility to recover from that shock. The key foibles of national macro policy, I think you have to have in the background here. And I spent 15 years with Federal Reserve System advising the president of the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank on monetary policy, saw exactly how this stuff was being done. I have a track record of having forecast the S&L meltdown that occurred at the end of the 90s. I forecast the meltdown of the European Currency Union in 1993, 1 year before it was formed. I forecast the housing crash in 2000 in front of an audience at the, not the Commonwealth Club, but at the Rotary Club. And what forecasts I offer here, I would say I have a little bit of, I'm not claiming great street creds here, but I did serve for 9 years on the Oregon Investment Council. And during that time, the positions and opinions I took to that council allowed that fund to be the best performing fund over $1 billion in the United States. And I was chair at the time that those achievements occurred. So that's a sales pitch, I guess, more than anything else, but also just to hope that you don't think that I'm as crazy as I sound. Since 1979, national policy encouraged HUD, Fannie, Freddie, and bank regulators to push junk mortgage loans. If someone tells you it was Wall Street, read reckless endangerment, and your mind will be changed. But they certainly were the enablers. They were the drug mules, but they weren't the smugglers. They were the mules. The post-crash policies in this area, that policy defied financial gravity. What I mean by that is we want the share of home ownership jumped by 5 percentage points as a result of a whole slew of these policies. That should have been a red light. It was to me, and it happened just started post-1995. You could see it coming like a freight train. But that was a policy. That was not the economy losing its way. That was not market forces losing their way. Similarly, the post-crash policies are focused on pain killing rather than letting imbalances work their course. It's been save the poor class person, poor person A, save the poor person B, save the poor person C. In the meantime, actually inserting further incentives to leverage the problem and to make foreclosure, exacerbate foreclosures. I can go with any of these details that you want. The second huge problem, this is not just our problem, but a world problem, as the housing policy problem was too. Spain and England and everybody else did exactly the same thing on housing policy. Everyone should be able to own a home, even if they've never paid their car payment on time. Second is, we made promises the economy can't keep. We've made it in health care, public pensions, Social Security, energy policy, environmental policy. Every one of those things is great. So it says it's got to be kept within the bounds of what we can pay, what we can afford to pay. Then we exhumed John Maynard Keynes. I wasn't there at the actual exhumation, but somehow all of a sudden he became popular after essentially 50 years of having been demonstrated that his principles were wrong. The myth was revived that public spending somehow can jumpstart the economy in any significant way. No one thinks it can't jumpstart the economy in a small way. The consensus among most economists who have studied this empirically is that the jobs multiplier on a dollar of spending, of public spending, is something between zero and one. You either get your money back at one extreme or you get nothing back at the other extreme. Some people argue it's negative. I don't advance that notion in my own mind. The implicit weakness of the Keynesian perspective is that it assumes resources will be better deployed if deployed by government, and that the private sector won't react to the rising debt, that should say debt or taxation that attends that policy. Both statements are false. If you look at the rate of productivity of the various sectors of the economy, the government sector is not where you would find high rates of productivity growth. So if you shift resources, this is kind of arithmetic, not even economics, from high productivity growth sectors to low, you've got to expect low productivity growth. And the fact, thinking that the private sector won't react to a rising debt of taxation, the stock market reacts every day to the slightest sneeze policymakers in this regard. Now, that's what leaves a legacy for the states and for Oregon. The national debt-to-GDP ratio now exceeds 100%. If you cluster all the countries in the U.S. that have, I'm sorry, in the world, that have a debt-to-GDP ratio, industrialized companies, greater than that, their average growth rate is only 2%, real growth rate per annum, or less. This is called the Japan syndrome. Japan has enjoyed a 0.6 annual growth rate since 1991 to today. That's what you get locked into. They have 224% debt to income. But that's what happens. People don't like to play with debtors. They don't like to play cards with debtors. They don't like to invest with debtors.
Yes, sir. Just a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Going back to the growth imbalances that we heard before, 1980 consumption, I'm sorry, household saving was 10%.
Mm-hmm.
2007, 0%. Household debt, 67%. 2007, 132%.
Right.
What came first, the chicken or the egg? The government or the people? Going down this debt,
there was
consumption, non-saving.
Representative Lindsay, very good question. I attended meetings in the redwood forests of Marin County in the 1980s where the notion of democratization of credit was the topic. Get everyone credit, liberalize whatever policies need to be liberalized to do that, which of course unfortunately proved to be mainly in the mortgage area. And that was the precipitating mentality. It began in the Carter administration, but I think every administration has contributed to it, or advanced it. To Greenspan's, one of the few kudos I'll give Greenspan is that he tried to bring the attention of the banking sector to that problem much earlier than other people remember him doing. But that was a problem. But what's interesting is that the mortgage bonds that are backed by credit card debt have been doing just fine. They have not pulled down the economy. It's only the mortgage-backed securities that have pulled the economy into the position that it's in. That gets to my second bullet point, Representative Lindsay, if I've answered your question. The housing sector is AWOL. If you've not been in the Army, that means away without leave, as a channel of stimulus. For all four 14 previous downturns, Fed policy used housing as a channel to stimulate growth, because all you had to do is tweedle interest rates, long-term interest rates, and housing would grow out of the ground. Housing is normally about 6% of GDP. It was 9% during the boom. It's 2% today. But we can't, unfortunately, push on that string, because the housing market, We've got a 10-year Treasury rate that's now below 2%. I heard a forecast today that it will drop to 1.4%. Treasury will be borrowing money at 1.4% for 10 years shortly as a result of the Fed's another brilliant, this is why I'm not at the Fed, I kept talking like this there too, policy of this twist, this rate twist that they've decided to pursue. But anyway, we've lost that tool. That tool's gone. It's AWOL. And business faces massive uncertainty. Remember, on the margin, I said this is where growth occurs. It doesn't occur on average. It occurs on the margin. I've associated with two private firms, one that I sold recently. But you add on the margin. Can I afford this guy on the margin? He's going to add on the margin. Is this machine going to add on the margin? And business faces massive uncertainty about all the things that mess up the margin. Healthcare costs, the cost of bank reform, and I include in that the recent Fed policy changes, tax policy, skilled labor availability, and all of that makes hiring weak. Then you go to the bank, and they say, well, hiring's weak. You know, why should we give to you? Your growth is lousy and your hiring is weak. So uncertainty holds about business holds back lending flows, which I'll demonstrate in a moment. Now, consistent with this, on the other hand, methods of substituting capital for labor are booming. If you'd own Oracle stock, you'd be rich, because basically Oracle replaces servers, replaces accountants with servers. And there's that kind of capital labor substitution going on, and that's going to be one of the things that's going to slow our recovery here, because once those machines are in place, once you no longer need your secretary, once you no longer need your drafters or your artists or your, you know, whatever, they're gone. And we're going to have to be much more aggressive about growing firms to get the growth on the margin than we have been in the past, because there's going to be this, and I come from a firm that has done this. We have one secretary for 60 people. Consistent with that, too, is the flight to security of Treasury debt. The reason Treasury debt is so low is because everybody's scared witless about any place else to put their money. So everyone's been buying Treasury debt, raising the price of the bonds, lowering the interest rate, and people around the world are doing that. You'd be rich, too, if you'd held Swedish kroner or the Swiss franc. The Swedes and the Swiss and the Dutch and the Danes were smart enough to keep the heck out of the currency union. So that's a legacy. Now let's look at the choices. This is where I start getting a little specific. This isn't really where I make the points that are going to offend you all, but you can look forward to that shortly. Hints from the data. Economic growth 2000 to 2010. Oregon minus 1.3. The rest of the country, actually it includes us, 0.4%. Unemployment rate, we're higher, as I think Joe pointed out, we're not as high or as we used to be because of this high beta thing that he and I both agree on. Home price growth, ours nearly doubled, the nation as a whole about 70%. This is the home price growth to the depths of the housing recession, as it were. If I'd used a higher number, you could have seen even higher housing home price growth rates. So that's, pause there just for a second, what we might intuit from that is that we've got high home prices that might be a concern for mobility of the people we kind of want to move here. Maximum personal income tax, 11%, the average elsewhere, 5.5. Maximum corporate, these are the maxima, 11.25, 6.5 elsewhere. I think Tom Petowski said, don't listen to anybody who starts talking about taxes, but sorry, I have too many private clients who think about taxes to think that they're not important. Not the thing, of course not, that's silly, but on some margin, they're incredibly important. And right now, we stand out like a sore thumb on this balance. And moreover, on the margin, this margin of the of where the little salmon grow to big salmon, that 11% is sitting, in case of corporations, on top of a 35% U.S. corporate rate.
President Wagner, and just because I have to keep track of the time and we have 11 more witnesses after this hearing, Representative Wagner, yeah, if you could speed it up just a little. Representative Wagner.
I'll keep it quick. Actually, you're not saying anything that offends me, and I agree with most everything that you're saying, but I just want to catch on the personal income tax rate. You have us there, and then you're 5.5 with others, but are you figuring in the sales tax for other states, since we're one of the few that just rely on?
We'd look good if I had a line for the sales tax there. This is literally just the personal income tax rates and the corporate income tax rates, not figuring in the sales tax rates at all. Yeah, no, that's right. These are taking the maximum, because there are progressive rates. I've taken the highest rate because economic theory says that's the only one that really matters on the margin, because it's the rich folk on the margin who are making the investment decisions, blah, blah. But no, I just wanted a line for sales tax. If I had, that might have been a little bit fair. We don't have that.
I just wanted to be fair for everybody here, but
absolutely.
Other than that, I agree with everything you're saying.
Okay, so. Well, thank you very much. But now, personal income growth per capita, 2010, we're ranked 43rd. 50 is bad, first is good. Property taxes, a percent of home value, we're 15th. First is good, 50th is bad. I'm sorry, first is bad, 50th is good. Same thing with the next one as a percentage of income. Share of income that's capital gains. The reason that that's important, we're 41st. We're, you know, we've got Alabama and places like that below us. The reason that that's important is because capital gains come from selling businesses, buying and selling capital creatively. And I take that as only one indicator of several things that are follow, which are the paucity of venture and private equity interest in the state of Oregon. Private and venture equity deal flow, we rank 21st. Venture capital investment per worker, 130 in Oregon, 226 in the state of Washington. Small business lending, only 2,500. I'm sorry. Yes.
Hard time reconciling your set the sentence immediately before you, then you said venture and private equity deal flow 21st. So where are we in terms of population? What would you say our number ought to be, all other things equal, if 21st is a lousy number for us?
Well, that's venture and deal flow on a population adjusted basis.
It'd be nice to be in the top 10, but we're better than 25th. We're better than
Being at 21 is better than being at 50th, absolutely.
Or 22nd.
Right, absolutely. Yep. Small business lending per worker, 2,500 in Oregon, 27. I picked Washington as our sister state on some of these things because when you see these big differences just across a river, you start thinking about it. Financial institutions per 100,000 workers, one of the other economists already mentioned this, only 2.1 per 100,000 workers here, 2.9. So the financial intermediaries are not gone, but they aren't working very hard for us. And yet, the small business share of employment is 42% in Oregon and 34% in Washington. Having been involved with three small businesses, I can tell you if someone tells you that the cost of credit is low, they don't own a business. And now here's where Tom will rankle. Just what are we? Are we a right-to-work state? No. Do we have a state death and inheritance taxes? Yes. Do we have a state Davis-Bacon Act raising the cost of public sector investments? Yes. Do we have a minimum wage far in excess of the federal? Yes. How about our education? Fourth grade reading proficiency in 2009, we ranked 32. 50 is bad, 1 is good. Math, 33. 50 is good, 1 is bad. Bachelor's degrees are more, high school graduates are more, 19th. That's on the top. top half anyway. Bachelor's degree or more, 19th, again, top half or more, that's okay. Workers' comp, right, as a share of a labor cost, that's something employers care about a lot. We rank 10, that's high. Public employees per capita, 14, just says something about the relative size of the public sector that you haven't heard before. And carbon emissions per capita, 41st, that's good. But it also means we don't have to sweat that badly our environmental policy if we have to pause on it to get the economy going. That's the purpose of that. Implications, the data are consistent with interventions of policy. None of those things happened because they just happened. Oregon cannot micromanage itself to health any more than it was successful micromanaging itself to into the place where we are. We're being led by the macroeconomy. But we can remove growth impediments by limiting disincentives to profit and entrepreneurship, eliminating heavy-handed economy-stifling intrusions into important markets, reforming selected public sector functions to get the consumer back in the decision process, and rebalancing toward a greater private sector role. Don't keep allocating resources to a sector that doesn't grow. And this, I don't know if this makes sense, but instead of planning away, let's get out of the way. If I had to give you a soundbite piece of research. And then here's a modest to-do list for those of you who have a kamikaze tendency. Encourage Oregon's congressional delegation to abandon counterproductive public spending and higher tax rate remedies, lower or eliminate the state corporate income tax, stop taxing capital gains as ordinary income, encourage venture capital and private equity. I'm a advisory limited partner on several venture capital funds, and why don't people come to Oregon? Why would you want to exit, have a $1 billion profitable exit of a venture investment in Oregon and be hit with an 11% tax? Why would you do that? Return to a flat and lower rate personal income tax. Stop subsidizing technology the market won't pursue on its own. I have a different opinion than Tom does about the green industry. I think the green industry is primarily a distraction. It's perhaps larger in Oregon and better paid because it's largely publicly financed. Not because the private sector is tripping all over itself to hire people at $25,000 a year with Windex sprayers in their hands to wash off windmills. The private sector isn't doing that. Allow out-of-state sellers to compete in the sale of health and workers' comp insurance, and limit health insurance mandates imposed by the state. Repeal the Davis-Bacon Act to lower the cost of public projects. Return parental choice to the K-12 system. You know, it is kind of interesting. Think of all the countries that are having trouble in Europe. Netherlands is not one of them. They've had full school choice for 70 years. Denmark is not one of them. It's had full school choice for 150 years. Look to the states that are having trouble. They don't have this policy. And I think it will help. It's not a spend policy. It's a deliver the goods in a different way policy. Loosen land use regulations somewhat anyway to make more sites available. There's no industrial land sites in Oregon that would attract certain types of businesses. Reconsider the effects of the Oregon minimum wage on youth job experience. I think that's almost a criminal thing that we're doing. We've set that rate so high that no one can afford to hire the kid who is basically unemployable and get him or her to the point where he is employed or she is employable. Pass right-to-work legislation. Tom didn't like that. Use market-like usage fees or taxes instead of mandates or standards. If you ever hear the word standard, run the other way, in my view. Reform public facility investment decisions and usage fees levies to be more market-like. Do this first for highways, because transportation is a key input to economic activity. We've chosen not to build more freeways, and probably on balance, additional capacity probably shouldn't have been built, but if we were going to limit the capacity, we should have priced it so it would be used efficiently. So I think with that, I think those are all of my points, and you've been very graceful in attending to my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm happy you shared with us your modest list and not your complete list. And I'm happy for the specifics, and I'm happy for the range of alternatives that the four of you have provided us with. It's just exactly what I was hoping for, and I really appreciate your time. Members of the committee, we are 7 minutes over the time for this. Representative Lindsay, you ask your question, but if it goes over, we're going to have to somehow take it
this
out.
This can be a statement. I think that Jefferson and Dave could use this as a platform. Can we get that a copy to them?
Certainly. Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually do have a question about where our committee crosses over here with transportation and economic development. We've got we spend a lot of time debating in this committee the value of different modes of transportation. I'd like to hear from some economic development folks kind of how the ranking of what the economic value of some of the different modes of transportation in the trade sector between rail, air, marine, and auto, and then in sort of the in the talent sector, automobile, bicycle, pedestrian, kind of where that breaks down, the rankings, where we should be spending more money, where we should be spending less.
I think for today's purposes, Representative, we're going to have a follow-up in November, and we are going to have the folks from various departments address that issue. The focus, but if we want one to come up, that's going to rob us of the time to listen to the other people travel a long way to testify to us in the next section of our hearing.
So if
one of you wants to say something about it, please do so, but take about 30 seconds.
All right.
Any of the four of you?
I would simply just make the point that
you
don't know what's underbuilt or overbuilt if you're not pricing it properly. So that's the part of the point of one of my observations here, that use market-like investment and usage fee decisions to price transportation. So we don't know whether we need more freeways or not because we're not pricing the ones that we have properly.
Thank you. And Patrick, if you could add that to make sure that gets on our November agenda. Are there any other questions for this panel that are fairly brief? Okay, with that, thank you, the four of you, very, very much. And I wish we had 30 minutes to cross-examine you, but we don't. And you provided exactly what I had been hoping for. So with that, we're going to take a 5-minute recess. we'll come back to order. We're moving to our second area of interest and exploration, Oregon exports issues and opportunities. And the concept that the previous co-chair and current co-chair and I worked with was to ask folks who were involved with exports to appear before this committee and suggest to us what we might do better to prompt more export activity to and from Oregon. And to kind of introduce this concept, we've asked Dr. Werner once again to lead off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be very brief with the overview, and then you can hear from folks that have been really more directly involved in export activity. One thing I did want to mention, because we started this some time ago, and I don't know how aware of all the members are, but in the economic forecast document itself that comes out every quarter, there is a section on the International Review and Outlook, which I think has some good information if you haven't followed that in terms of where the major export markets are for Oregon. Has the latest export trade data from Oregon, the so-called MISER data, and that's updated each quarter. And of course, we recognize that export activity is a key factor influencing the economic forecast. So that's worth looking at if you haven't done that. It's a good survey of what's happening around the world.
And where is it again?
It's in the quarterly economic and revenue forecast.
Thank you.
It's section B. So it comes right after the national forecast.
Thank you.
And the numbers that I'll cite here real quickly are drawn from that latest forecast, the September numbers. Just a couple of things to kind of reinforce what I had said earlier. As the U.S. economy slows, and my remarks are on a one page for you. As the U.S. economy slows, and the imbalances that we've talked about that have built up over the last 25 years, we do think exports are going to be a key factor for long-term growth for the state, and actually, or for the country, and therefore the state. You know, when you think about it, trying to correct a trade imbalance, most economists will tell you it's going to happen some way. We've maintained this imbalance because of some institutional factors surrounding the U.S. dollar, but there are really two ways you correct a trade imbalance. One is a reduction in imports, the other is an increase in exports. Usually a reduction in imports is a lot more painful process because it usually means you've got less income. So the way to make that balance that's beneficial for the U.S. and state economies is through increasing exports. Not that there can't be some what we call import substitution along the way as well. We've also seen from the chart we looked at earlier, two of the Pacific Northwest is one of the leading export-sensitive regions. Washington, with 15.6% of its GDP associated with exports, I think they're number four. The last data I looked at, they were number two. And Oregon, at 10.2%, is also well above the national average in terms of exports as a percentage of gross state product. Now, the largest export markets from the 2010 export data by state, for Oregon, were China, which has emerged as the largest export market, a little over $4 billion at $4.04 billion for the 2010 year. Second is Canada at $2.4 billion. Third is Japan at $1.4 billion. And, I remember in the 1990s, when we first really started tracking this data, Japan was consistently number one. So there's been that shift as Japan has slowed through their period of weak growth. But there's still a major trading partner for the state, ranking number three among the countries. Number four is South Korea at $937 million for 2010, and number five is Taiwan at $670 million. So very much an Asian orientation, as you would expect, given our geography, but we do have trading partners in Europe as well, particularly in products that have relatively low shipping costs, like high-tech, for example, that can be shipped by air. So Oregon is very much sensitive to the export markets. And one of the things we do track because of that is how those economies are doing. Obviously, that affects their demand for Oregon-based products. The industries where we see from 2010 the largest export activity is our friend consumer and electronic products, again, as we saw, was the largest component of durable goods manufacturing, which was a key driver in the state. Computer and electronic products make up 34.5% of state exports. And that's actually down somewhat as Intel had reduced some of their exports they had to subsidiaries, predominantly in Ireland over the last year or so, as there was a product cycle development going on. So high-tech is about a third of our exports. Agricultural products, of course, the major factor outside the Portland metro area are 16.1%. I shouldn't say outside. I should say the urbanized area, because Clackamas County is one of the major export or agricultural-oriented counties, along with Marion County as well. So 16.1% agricultural products, and chemicals are 10.1%. So that makes up a little over 50% from those three major industries. Again, there's more detail in that report from the Office of Economic Analysis. I'm just going to conclude my remarks with a couple of comments about policies that influence export activity. The first I would mention is marketing, and I think you've got a good list of presenters here that can go into the details of what that may involve. But I would include things, for example, such as producer information about markets, because when you're talking about international trade and exports, you're talking about a real premium on information, because a lot of times you're a smaller company in particular, you're dealing with markets you're unfamiliar with particular regulations or particular customs or a culture of different markets that you're unfamiliar with, and you can obviously see a role there for the public sector in providing that information and assistance to that kind of growth. And keep in mind that there's no monopoly on the part of large corporations for export activity. Smaller companies in Oregon and in many states, are exports are a key factor for them. I think the Germans, the Mittelstand in Germany, have made a key part of that economy, the smaller, medium-sized companies that have been major exporters and have been a key reason for Germany's competitiveness historically. So marketing would be the first thing. The second point I would say in terms of policies influence are the same things we talked about earlier when we had the general economic discussion, and that is the overall competitiveness of the state economy, because the productivity of your labor force and the ability to attract labor and capital, those are the things that will drive the high value-added exports. So obviously that will improve our competitive position, not only within the U.S., but in the world economy. And you're back to those kinds of policies that may influence that we talked about, more destination-based taxes, for example, in other words, consumption-based taxes. Destination-based taxes obviously are not going to be taxing exports. For example, the value-added tax is used in Europe. Exports there's credits against exports. They're not taxed for exports, but the domestic consumers are, or domestic producers are taxed. Leverage federal tax incentives. And one thing that we have worked some on with Senator George right at the tail end of the session and doing some more work on is federally created organizations such as the ICDISC may provide some financing for companies that are export-oriented, is what they're designed to do, and ability to leverage some of those federal policies. And then finally, I think the key to as it is for any export with a small e, anything producing in Oregon, selling outside the state, it's the predictability of public services, predictability of the tax structure. And in order to do that, and I think you saw a pretty wide consensus from the economic presentation that Oregon is a volatile state based on its structure and its structure of its economy and its revenue structure. Anything you can do to maintain a strong reserve policy and maintain predictability and stability in those services is a net plus for exporters. So that's my comments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Paul. And with that background, we're going to turn to Jin Lan, who this gives me the opportunity to thank for all your work in assisting in our recent visit to China. And there are four of us up here that went on the trip, and what I think I'm going to do, Jen, is ask these four to, or three of you at least, to comment on their thoughts, what they saw, and then you can correct all of us and tell us what we really saw or should have seen. So let's start with Representative Lindsay first, and maybe you could just comment on what you saw as the shortest possible summary of export opportunities. It is, I must say,
the shortest.
To everyone who's here, the 2 weeks in China leaves one, at least in my case, fairly speechless, but we'll see. Go ahead.
I've been trying to boil this down, and ultimately the major takeaway is that I feel that China is increasingly dependent on America for innovation, and I also feel that America is increasingly dependent on China for manufacturing. And two issues that concern me, and they might be more of a federal issue to address with the federal delegation, and that is, number one, China's indigenous innovation policy, which is a primary concern to any WTO issues, and that is China, I understand, with that policy, continues to favor innovation that comes from China. I think that's because they want to become less dependent on our innovation, but I think that policy is counterproductive to this codependent relationship. And then the second thing is technology licensing. I know that China itself, the government, imposes a limitation on royalties for technology licensing. I think that serves as a disincentive to innovators in the U.S. that want to export manufacturing, even just durable goods themselves, to China, especially when the royalties are capped, and the government is coming in on those licensing agreements. So those are two things that stand out in my mind. Whether that can be addressed here at the state level or the federal level, possibly both, it'd be nice to figure that out.
Thank you, Representative Sheehan.
First, scorpions taste horrible.
That's not true.
So I had some observations about China. They have a ton of construction going on, but one of the things that I observed was that none of it was getting finished. That it was a whole lot of cranes on the tops of a whole lot of buildings that weren't going anywhere. I suspect that their GDP is largely inflated by this construction that's being fueled by municipal government borrowing, and that was sort of reinforced by some of the newspaper articles that I read while I was over there. But way more than that was just observing this thing. So that got me to thinking, you know, is the big threat from China as an economic force, is that really real, or are they really headed for an economic sort of collapse as we have? Because I was just thinking about the buildings that we've got on the South Waterfront, and those are, you know, three or four buildings we've got out there. We saw hundreds in China that were much larger than that, including an 80-story tower in Tianjin that doesn't have a single occupant right now after a year. Very, very scary. The biggest conclusion I think I came to is after visiting the K-12 school and seeing their classrooms and seeing these kids packed in here where they go to school from 7 in the morning till 10 at night, and they don't switch classrooms. The teachers come to them. They don't really have competitive sports. They stand in a football field with no seats around it because nobody's going to watch them do this except the occasional legislator. But they stand there and move their arms like this for 10 minutes, and that's their exercise. And it seems like we have just a huge cultural difference between the United States and China. And as I was looking at what they were doing in their classrooms and sort of the questions they were answering, it occurred to me that this is not a workforce that we should fear. It's a workforce that we should attract, and that we need to make things like, is it the EB-4 visa? Is that the
EB-5?
EB-5 visa. Work visas for folks to come over here and work in those engineering positions where they don't. Okay, well, Jim doesn't agree with me, but I'll articulate my point a little bit further.
Our unemployment rate's at 10%.
So. Well, the thing is, we don't have people to fill those positions. In the American students grow to become visionaries, and they grow to have context for the math and for the science. Where we're lacking right now is in the workforce for actually doing the equations, and I think bringing that workforce over to fill that gap, I think makes a lot of sense, and we'd grow some companies that right now need that sort of discipline in their labor force. So I see higher ed as a major opening that we've got to attract kids to come study abroad, and perhaps we can work something out to where companies that offer internships for American students to make those sort of visas available for Chinese workers to come over, so that we're growing American students through the system, but we're also have a workforce coming over that's more heavily disciplined and, quite frankly, just a lot more skilled at math and science. And scorpions are bad.
Thank you. Co-chair.
Thanks. It's, I mean, it really, one thing after spending a couple weeks in China, you really do appreciate the benefit of blue sky and lack of what they call fog in China, which is not the fog of San Francisco or other places. But I think the, and I to put it in context, I've been to China and Taiwan on four different trips over the last 6 years, I guess. And just watching the development, because Representative Sheehan is right, the huge amount of, I mean, you can look any direction in just about any city in China or Taiwan and just see a massive amount of construction. And they're not just constructing any one thing. They're constructing housing. They're constructing commercial. They're constructing industrial, heavy rail, high-speed rail, ports, roads, bridges. And it's really all over the map. And I've seen over that time period a lot of those projects are getting done. We also saw the Three Gorges Dam project, which is just an unbelievably large project that is just really changing the face of that part of China. But they're making the investments. It's probably the most discouraging thing coming home and seeing, whether it's on infrastructure or on education, where they are really making the investments. I mean, when it comes to education, they're not only making the investments there, they're actually making the investments in educating other people in other countries about Chinese language and culture. So they really have a much bigger vision, I think, in that respect, that we could grab a corner of. But specific to exporting, one of the pieces of good news is just really looking at the progressive growth of the Chinese middle class, and that consumer base for U.S. exports is just, I mean, the trend lines are just all positive, I think. And that's a wide variety of U.S. exports. Those are really encouraging. The opportunities for foreign direct investment of Chinese dollars in American businesses, I think, is also a huge, not fully tapped resource, a lot of potential there. And then I'm sure Jin is going to talk about the opportunity for greater tourism, bringing Chinese visitors here, and the restrictive problems we've got in terms of visa restrictions, even on, I mean, leave alone on workers trying to come here, but just on Chinese visitors here that could be spending money here visiting Oregon. There's a ridiculous set of federal restrictions here. But probably the highlight for me of the trip to China was hearing Representative Richardson make a presentation before a whole group of business leaders and touting Oregon's low tax environment. That had to be the highlight of the trip for me right there.
He had food poisoning. He wasn't in his right mind.
I think he was referencing the duty-free nature of Oregon. Kind of a
salesman will sell anything to get an order, huh?
Version of our non-sales tax status. My observations were of a really young country of an incredible scale, unbelievable number of folks compared to your entire baseline of how you think about business is challenged when you get there, because 1.3 billion people is so many more than that, just a billion more than we have in the United States. It's a really young nation. The enthusiasm we saw in the schools was amazing when compared to the lack of it I see in our schools. It was embarrassing, frankly, in retrospect. The opportunity to deal with China, I think, is great, just because I think the demand is so great. The challenges the country faces are apparent: pollution, huge difficulties there. The one thing, though, that all of us remarked upon is the lack of transparency, and I don't know how that's going to affect that country in the long run. Reading the newspapers there is, I don't quite know how to say this, but the newspapers there are very, very shallow in how they analyze things. It's like comparing the old Weekly Reader we would get in school to the Wall Street Journal. So you really don't, at least I was unable in the time I was there, I don't read Chinese, that maybe there's a problem, to figure out anything about what's truly going on. Although there was some pretty forthright remarks about difficulties they encountered in putting in linear projects, freeways and whatnot, and some problems with development and condemnation issues. Anyway, my thought is there's great opportunity there. I'm very happy, Jin, that you took the time to share with us your expertise and taking us through the country and putting up with all of the challenges a group like us present. So with that, maybe you could share with us your thinking on what opportunities Oregon might take advantage of.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs. Distinguished committee members, audience. My remarks today is going to be mainly focused on specific steps. I think the economists before me have indicated clearly that for our economy to grow, there are two things, like export and investment. So my remarks today is really focusing on 8 steps that the state of Oregon can take in order to take the advantages of the opportunities in China. I think that committee members and the co-chairs have made very perceptive observations in terms of the trip to China. They're valid. But how the state of Oregon can take advantage of the economic growth in China is a key issue before us. I think in the next 5 to 10 years, China's economy is continue to grow average about 7 to 9% a year. For us, it is a great opportunity to figure out a way to ride on that economic trend. Keep in mind that the state of Oregon has limited resources, and previous presenters also have indicated that we're a small state. So my remarks really going to illustrate two things. Like, one is we have limited resources. Two, my recommendation here is China-specific for export and investment does not necessarily apply to Europe or Japan or Korea. So the first thing is that we need to pull in limited state resources by establishing an authoritative body, maybe we call it Oregon-China Relations Council or something, to coordinate more than a dozen of civic and state entities in working with China. This particular body would be nominated by the legislature and perhaps approved by the governor. It will be the most authoritative body dealing with our multifaceted relations with China. For those legislators who have visited China in the past, I think you all have experienced that in China, the face and also the perception of power are very important. Right now, in the state, we have a whole bunch of organizations, but they're all very small. They're all focused on a particular area. There's no very unified and coordinated body to deal with China. When we have a visitor to come here, for instance, if governor is not available, we really can't find a lieutenant governor to, you know, greet our guest. So that's one issue. Second of all, most of the legislators on this trip, their first stop is in Xiamen, which is a major city in Fujian province. Fujian and Oregon have established the sister state in 1984. However, my recommendation to the committee is that we will continue to deepen our relationship with Fujian, but on the other hand, we need to reach out and diversify our economic relations with other part of China. The other part of China that complements our economic clusters, not compete with our industry clusters. The third recommendation is I think the state of Oregon need to figure out a way or system to reward Chinese businessmen or entities who can bring investment to Oregon to create jobs. It's some of the ways, for instance, you can give a government award and not necessarily a financial reward. Number four would be working with Oregon congressional delegations to clear the visa issues for Chinese visitors. This is particularly important for us because when we go out trying to sell Oregon, the immediate feedback, I think, is that, you know, we have a hard time to get a visa. Senator Wyden recently wrote a letter to Hillary Clinton trying to address this issue. But I think we need to continue to work with our congressional delegation to solve this problem. Otherwise, export investment become a very feckless slogan. Number five, we need investing more money to a dedicated China representative office by combining perhaps all the state related agencies, Port of Portland, Business Oregon, Travel Oregon, ODA, etc. Number six, we need to promote annual visit by our state legislators and governors on trade missions to China. Typically for other states and for even other countries, that generally our political leaders will go out and set up a platform for the private enterprises to play. The trade mission should really deal with specific issues Oregon company encounter in a very competitive marketplace in China. Number seven, this is also something I think our legislators have experienced. We need to establish a proper protocol and setting up fundings in welcome Chinese dignitaries and VIP visitors. And we also need to increase bilingual employees in our state government. Last but not least, we need to beef up Oregon's lead in Mandarin learning and other culture and education exchanges. That's my recommendation based on my experience in doing consulting works for different clients and companies. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you again for all of your help with our group in China. The assistance was amazing, and the opportunity presented is too great to pass up, so your suggestions are excellent. Let's start with Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, I wanted to mention that even though I was not part of a legislative delegation to China, I did travel to China a couple of years ago. I spent more than 2 weeks in the country, very much enjoyed my visit, and even enjoyed parts, I don't know if I should say this out loud, the few times when I was not accompanied or with a guide, those were some of the best times when I could just walk around a town for 3 or 4 hours on my own and experience the neighborhoods and the pace of life. I wanted to ask two things. I'd like to know a little more about the difficulty in obtaining visas. I know what it was like for me. It took time and money and patience, but is there additional burden on Chinese visitors to our country? Is it beyond just cost and time and burden? Are there other specific difficulties? And the other thing I wanted to ask about is, what do we know about how many school districts in Oregon offer special language and culture curriculum about China or to learn Chinese language? Do we know how many?
Okay. Let me answer the first question. The visa issue, to be fair, after 9/11, we had a very tough visa restrictions for Chinese visitors. In the last 2 years, visa situation has improved tremendously. It used to be about 50% rejection rate. Now I think it's about probably 10 to 15% rejection rate, so a lot better. However, state Oregon has a particular issue. That is, we have a sister state relation with Fujian. And the Fujian people has a particular difficulty in obtaining visa to come to Oregon because Fujian has had a legacy of illegal immigrants in the past. So the burden of approval is on Fujian side. However, when our delegation visited Xiamen, I think we have witnessed the economic progress in Fujian in the last 10, 20 years. So the excuse, the reason for illegal immigrants to come to the United States for economic reasons has reduced substantially. So the letter from Senator Wyden to Secretary Hillary Clinton is trying to address this particular dimension, that is, the economic incentive for Fujian people to come to U.S. as some sort of economic refugee has decreased substantially. During our last several years, there are a lot of potential visitors who from Fujian who want to come, even their billionaires, but they dressed very lousily when they went on the interview with the U.S. Embassy, and it just got turned down. The basic process for the Chinese visitors to come to U.S. To apply a visa, one is you have to have a letter invitation. Then you need to fill in an application form online. Then you have to schedule a face-to-face interview, and it costs roughly about $200-some. And in different regions of China, they have to travel to where the U.S. Embassy consulate is located. So that could involve more traveling money to get a visa. And in the case of Fujian, when they do travel to Guangzhou, which is about probably several hundred miles, 90% of their visa will be rejected. So this is a particular burden on part of Oregon because we're sister states. That's why. Second question on your on the Chinese learning. Currently, Oregon has 13 Confucius classrooms. Eight of them, I believe, is in the Portland area, and then the other two is outside of Portland. Then we have two Confucius Institute, one is in PSU, another one, I think, in Eugene. So that's the extent in terms of the Chinese learning and cultural education.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Early in the, I don't know if it was this committee or general government, but Brian Klim had a bill that had to do with naming the Secretary of State as the person that goes in place of the governor if the governor can't make it. Can you speak to whether that's useful or whether that would have been good on this trip? I know we, with our delegations, the governor's schedule didn't mesh up with ours real well, so.
It helps. At least it gives Chinese visitors some sense of reciprocity. I think when we go to China, we have received tremendous hospitality and VIP treatment. When we have dignitaries from China, if governor is busy, generally, they sort of left in a lurch. We need to figure out a way to show our hospitality, show our respect. But I don't know what would be the best way. For instance, if in governor's office we have another designated greeter, levy, very helpful. Oh, even in the legislature, we can, designate someone. Protocol-wise, I think that'd be very helpful. If a Secretary of State can function as a sort of governor's representative, a special envoy, I think that would help as well.
Yeah. Chin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking it. We'd like to take more time, but we've got other folks signed up. So thank you so much for coming down and sharing your very good ideas with us. And with that, we're going to move to, I think, a Skype presentation. Is that right? Is our presenter standing? There she is. So can you hear us, Amy? Is that right?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me okay?
I might turn it up just a little. Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead. And I understand you're going to talk about exports opportunities also. So proceed.
Yes. Great. Well, thank you, Co-Chairman and the committee, for this opportunity to join you remotely on this important topic. In fact, I really enjoyed hearing about your observations from your recent trip to China. The one thing I wanted to mention to you that is, if you see me waving my arms, it's only because I'm sitting in a motion-censored room for the lighting, and it might go dim on me in a moment. But I do hope to cover three points today. I want to talk about the importance of boosting exports and globalizing the state's economy in today's environment. I want to talk about an innovative effort underway in Greater Portland to develop an export initiative with the help of Brookings. And I want to offer some broad thoughts on how the state can support a bottom-up approach to a trade economy. Now, I believe I gave you some slides in advance, and I hope you have that before you as I walk through some key stats today. What I want to start by reinforcing is the urgency of today's economic picture, which I know you've covered a lot already today. But let me just mention a few stats. We're clearly in this time we need more jobs because the U.S. has lost 8.8 million jobs over the course of the recession, and we have regained only one-fifth of them to date. We also need better jobs because this has honestly been a brutal decade for low, moderate, and middle-income workers. The 2000s was, in fact, the first decade on record in the U.S. where the median family household income actually declined by more than $3,800 per household. And we also have too many people. There we go. I apologize. This is the one they gave me.
Greenness.
It's a good sustainable effort. Obviously, we have too many people that are still disconnected from the job market. So nearly 1 in 10 working Americans remain without a job, and that is the same statistic and share in this state, in Oregon, in this Portland metropolitan area. So where do we go from here, given these stark realities? What's clear is we cannot go back to the prior economy, the one that was highly fueled by debt, overconsumption, and real estate speculation. What we need is a new growth model that focuses on the productive end of our economies, our tradable sectors, that create quality jobs and support the growth of local serving jobs. But we also must tap the demand from growing markets in nations like Brazil, India, and China, where you visited, that can serve as a source of growth for our sluggish economy. So let me start with the first point, which is that we need to pursue a different kind of economy that is going to be driven by powered by low-carbon clean technologies, and I know that a prior speaker had doubts about that, and I certainly can give you statistics on the contrary, fueled by innovation and rich with opportunity. Now, at the heart of this post-recession economy is exports. So why exports? If you look at the next chart in front of you, what you'll see is that we need to rebalance the U.S. economy. Americans have been consuming too much and exporting too little. The left set of bars, and I realize there are some bars that are missing, the left shows that over the last 30 years, the share of GDP in the U.S. that has been fueled by consumption has risen by 7 percentage points to 70%, but it's basically stayed constant in other large developed countries like Canada, France, Germany, Japan, and the U.K. Now, meanwhile, exports as a share of GDP growth rose by almost 7 percentage points in these G7 nations, but they barely budged for the U.S., so we grew to about 13% share of our GDP. So if you go to the next slide, the slide shows that our 13% reliance on exports as a share of GDP lags in a stark comparison to those of mature and developing economies like our trading partners in Canada, China, and India that have up to 30% of our economy from exports. And exporting is still an exception more than a rule in the U.S. According to the Department of Commerce, less than 1% of American companies actually sell a product or service outside of the U.S. And of those that do, less than half exported to more than one country. So while there are some barriers to exporting, the reality is that we have some untapped potential among our American firms to reach new customers. And I want to stress there are a lot of customers. With rapid urbanization and the rise of the middle class around the globe, which you witnessed on your recent trip, it is no surprise that 95% of the world's consumers live outside of the United States. So in short, boosting export is an economic imperative. The Great Recession has further shifted the growth map away from the U.S. and Europe. So if you take a look at that map in front of you, the top 30 global cities that grew or rebounded the fastest 1 year after the recession, shown in the orange, were almost exclusively located in emerging markets in Asia and Latin America. The 30 worst performers after the recession, shown in blue, were all located in Europe and the United States. So U.S. businesses will have a hard time expanding if they are solely reliant on our uneven domestic market. And finally, the movement of freight in the United States is compromised by an infrastructure that is still third class, a network of roads, trains, air, and ports that are not really well connected, and transportation routes that are still clogged and congested. Now, despite all this, I think we are well positioned to play in the export game. First, the U.S. remains the largest exporter of goods and services in the world. We manufacture a whole range of advanced goods that the world wants to buy, aircraft, medical instruments, high-quality pharmaceuticals, but also services such as higher education, management consulting, architecture services. And we also have a trade surplus in services, $168 billion in 2010. Now, further, the clean economy products are in high demand globally. Now, Oregon has the second highest share of clean economy jobs among the 50 states. And I know that sustainable industries will be a big part of the state's future economy. What that next chart shows is that exports in renewable energy, in energy efficient and sustainable goods and services, generate twice as much value per job than the typical U.S. export. Research also shows that firms in export-intensive industries also pay workers more and are more likely to provide health and retirement benefits. So in 2008, for example, the top five exporting industries in the U.S., advanced machinery, business services, transportation equipment, chemicals, computer electronic products, they all paid better than the national average wage by almost up to $40,000 more. So in sum, there are enormous opportunities and benefits to embracing an export-oriented economy. So let me move to my second point, that is that to deliver on the promise of the next economy, there are leaders in Greater Portland right now who are working together to develop and ultimately implement their own export initiative. Now, why do this at the metropolitan scale? I think many of you know that metropolitan areas are the engines of the global economy. As Harvard business professor once observed, there is no U.S. economy. There's just simply a network of hyperlinked, hyper-specialized metropolitan economies. And the metro economies span cities, suburbs, exurbs, and rural areas. In fact, about half of the nation's rural residents live inside of metropolitan areas. So this is not about promoting a rural or urban divide, but about leveraging the true economic units of our global economy. Move to the next slide. The 100 largest metropolitan areas make up just 12% of our land area and 65% of our population, but they are home to the bulk of the assets that drive the future economy.
Amy, excuse me for interrupting, but I can tell from the length of your slide presentation that we're going to run out of time. Before, okay. So can I get you to hop ahead to tell us exactly what we should do? Because
sure.
I've got, sadly, although I'd like to hear every last bit of your testimony, we're going to be down to 30 minutes, and I still have 9 people to testify.
Mr. Chair,
where are you? Where are you testifying from?
Okay, I'm sorry. I am testifying from the East Coast.
Okay, we're going to, if you could, go ahead, because there are certain people I can't, that have come quite a distance to testify and only have 30 minutes left. So if you could take 10 minutes and wrap up, that would be excellent.
I understand, and I was told about 10, 15 minutes, but I will certainly get through that. Thank you. So what I can do is jump ahead to obviously the strength of the metropolitan areas in Oregon. There are 6, and they drive 83% of the state's economic output, and Portland metro area alone generates 60% of the state's GDP. So why is Portland a good candidate for an export initiative? You'll see some statistics there. You'll see that Greater Portland performs strongly on exports, as the graph shows, ranking 12th in the nation in the volume of export sales and second in its pace of export growth over a 5-year period. I apologize.
So is she from Portland? Or is this just a source?
I'm sorry?
Oh, go ahead. We can see you now.
Okay. And so you've got other statistics in front of you that show you the nature of the export economy in Portland. What I wanted to show you, there is a slide there that shows what the top 10 exporting industries are. in the Portland area. Some of it's not a surprise because it's talked about earlier, but the computer electronic products such as Intel and TriQuint certainly make up a lion's share of those. But I also wanted to point out others. Travel and tourism, the data that Brookings puts together also includes services, which is unusual at the national level. So travel and tourism and agriculture products are also in the top 10 largest export sectors in the Portland metro area. What I wanted to also jump to then, given time constraints, is show you that there is a reverse group of, we are currently working with about four metropolitan areas to develop a metropolitan export initiative. You can see that in Portland, there's a really diverse group of leaders that are developing an export initiative right now. They start with statewide groups like Business Oregon, or the Business Oregon Agency, to a lot of diverse regional business, civic, political, government leaders, as well as federal. Both ITA, UZIAC, and SBA are currently partners in this effort. One of the things I also wanted to share with you is what we are in the process of developing a market analysis of what are the strengths and weaknesses for exporting for the Portland area. And what you see in that slide right now is a survey that we conducted that went to over 400 companies, half of whom do not export right now. And we asked them what their top export barriers are. And you'll see that those were the top answers from all those companies. First of all, a lot of them are unaware of the foreign opportunities within foreign markets. They don't have market data that also gives them the confidence to enter into these markets. There are issues around capacity to deal with marketing, capacity to deal with sales contract negotiations, concerns about transportation costs, financing, and obviously concerns about IP protection. But once they begin exporting, what we find is that businesses are amazed that they didn't export before, and that they can't imagine a business plan without global markets in mind. What you also see there are just some slides of what a regional export initiative, what kind of outcomes it would give to the state in terms of metrics that we are really hoping that we can get to. I think what I would just do is close with what are some things that the state can do to be a better partner to leaders in Portland or other regions in the state who may be interested in moving down the path to adopting trade and globalization. So first, that's the last slide here. What I really want to reinforce is that exports cannot be treated as a silo. It has to be part of a broader economic strategy that requires a continuum of interventions. In other words, an export strategy goes beyond export promotion, and it requires, first of all, the ability to create innovative products and services that the global customers will want to buy. So state efforts to boost R&D, venture financing, other supports for universities and firms to work through the innovation cycle is really important. Second, the state needs to continue to be a leader in advanced manufacturing. Again, you can see from, more than about 80% of the exports coming out of the Portland area is in manufacturing. So we need to continue to help manufacturers innovate and meet the needs of global economy. Third, we need to arm our young people and our existing workers with the skills and education needed to participate in manufacturing and services jobs of the future, but also related to a question that was asked earlier, there's a real need for increased global fluency and cultural education among the next generation of leaders, support for foreign languages in schools, support for the international business schools in our universities who are really critical partners to our trade agenda. Fourth, on export promotion, the state already has a strong program through Business Oregon, but the state could consider supporting regional efforts either by building direct partnerships with export service intermediaries in each of the core regions of the state. This is what Michigan is doing. Or you can consider providing competitive grants to regional organizations who are creating customized approaches of corporate companies to boost exports like they're doing in Washington State. And then finally, we need a strong focus on building a modern trade and infrastructure network that efficiently move goods and services, including on the services side, students, business, travel, but also about the air. So in closing, I just want to say that, you know, Brookings has been working with the Portland area on an export initiative. I've been very impressed with the leaders I have met in Greater Portland, and I look forward to working with them, with you, and other state of Oregon, and make sure that this state is a model for what it takes to move into a global economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you very much for consolidating your presentation. It's an excellent presentation. We very much appreciate you taking the time and the challenge to facility you are in there. So thank you so much. Are there any questions for our attendee by Skype? None. Thank you. Thank you very, very much, and we look forward to following up on some of the recommendations you've made.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. With that, members of the committee, I think we're going to move to. Scott Drum is here from the Port of Portland,
yes.
And I'm going to ask if you would wait while we move to, if that's all right with you, because we will be taking this issue up again possibly. And what I'd like to do is ask Paul Grove to come up. And I think Paul, you had a panel of three people. Is that right? Is that the concept? And the idea is that. You're going to introduce those three and tell us what they're going to share with us. So, Paul.
Sure. Thank you very much, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Grove with Business Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to talk about this important topic. As you know, our director and others are part of the governor's trade mission to Asia right now, and they'll be returning shortly. I know there was some overlap with your mission as well. So, it'll be real brief and recognize the time constraints. We do have a panel of three businesses here. Two of them we have worked with specifically at the department level through our trade promotion program that Amy referenced in her presentation. In particular, we have Adrian Poliak with Sam Medical and Ron Schneeberger with Plastifab. And the third business, I believe, is Van Decker with Decker Tree Farm, and was invited at the suggestion of the committee and very appreciative of all three of them taking the time to come to Salem and talk about their company, tell their story, and what export international trade opportunities mean to them.
And I think, Paul, what so people don't feel too rushed is that if each would take about 5 to 7 minutes in their presentations, that will work, and we can go slightly past 5 o'clock. I think the rest of our witnesses, Port of Portland, Department of Ag, and Travel Oregon can appear before us in November because they're all close by. I think that's the concept. So with that, who would you like to call up first?
Well, I would, co-chairs, members of the committee, I would suggest that if all three could come to the table and then at your discretion tell their stories accordingly.
Great. So if Poliak, Schneeberger, and Mr. Decker, if the three would come up. Who would like to go first?
Okay.
And if you'll move that microphone around, keep it about a foot away from you. There we go. And identify yourself, please.
My name is Ron Schneeberger. I'm with Plastifab Composites in Tualatin. We're a manufacturing company. We make composite products for fluid handling. And we're just under 100 employees right now. We took some setback during the slow down, but we're running pretty good right now. We've in 2007 we had just over $100,000 in export that was given to us without any effort, and mostly because our company's been around for over 40 years and we have a lot of specifications in the field and abroad as well. And so taking a look at that, we decided that if we could do that without even trying, maybe we could put an initiative together and bring in some more money and more jobs by doing some exports. This year, we're right now at just over $1 million in export and on pace for about $1.5 million, which is about 10% for our company, which is a pretty good increase over the last 5 years. We're actually intending to make that a 50% number within 5 years to have a 50% export And in the meantime, we have, of course, many programs to develop our domestic sales as well. So our focus is definitely towards export now in our overall strategy. We're part of the reason we're able to export our product is, like I mentioned, we've been around a long time, over 40 years, so we have that reputation being around. Also, we've been first in industry and revolutionized a lot of products in our industry for composites in the fluid control business. We also do all our own in-house engineering and design, which is valuable to a lot of the constituents that we have. We have a reputation for that kind of quality, and with what we can export, it's not something, and with us, it's, of course, it's not a consumer item. So it's a difficult market to negotiate when in industrial and municipal markets. So our strategy has been to develop a rep network, which we've had success with, large success. And one of the things that I think that I'd like to share is the process for a company to say, okay, we're going to export, and now where do we go? That there are good places to go. Business Oregon has been very valuable for us. And there's more private, the World Trade Center, the Portland Business Alliance, other organizations that are involved and can help. Of course, the federal level, the U.S. Commercial Service has been very valuable to us as well. But for the state, I think the best incentive for a company would be to help to provide some of that initial guidance. There are so many things for a small business, everything from the freight terms to negotiating contracts to with the different laws and rules for importing in different companies, even who's off limits to export to, all those little things that don't immediately come to mind. Well, those are the things that could make or break a company if they have to learn it by trial and error. So the programs that, like through Business Oregon, in other words, I think that more focus on employing and marketing even those tools that we already have could be very valuable for companies deciding to get into international marketing.
Did you utilize those services at all, or did you have to figure it out on your own?
Mostly we kind of a combination. We learned, they have a services with seminars and like the Incoterms seminars. I sent a couple people those. And then, of course, you can't teach it all. But because we were forewarned, we were forearmed, and we're able to negotiate through a lot of potentially dangerous situations. And then a lot of the other things with, we've used the Gold Key services the other service where they vet a company if you're going to go into business with them, like a credit report, but it's a real dossier. So yes, we've used a lot of those services.
I think we may have other questions from this panel. What I'd like to do is get through the other two's testimony. What we're most interested, at least what I'm most interested in, is hearing exactly what you just said, what you want Oregon to do differently to help exporters export more. So although a modest amount of background is okay, what we really want you to do is say, this is what you're doing, and you need to do it better. That would be the greatest, most productive thing you could do. So with that, Mr. Decker, and for the committee's knowledge, I've known Mr. Decker for many years, a good personal friend, and very happy to have him give me a call when he saw the very positive article in the paper about our junket to China. He gave me a call and said he'd like to talk about this export opportunity. So there was one good thing that came out of that article, and that's your presence here today. So with that, Mr. Decker, proceed. Yeah.
Thank you, sir. Yes, I'm a tree farmer from Philomath, Oregon, and I work with a logging company, and we log all the time. And we have been shipping, and the pictures I turned in have some pictures of logs we've been shipping. A certain select group of those logs.
I'm sorry, Van, could you say your name for the record?
Oh, my name is Van Decker.
Sorry.
From Corvallis, Oregon. A certain group of those logs, about 20% of the total harvest, has gone to a special market in China to be made into plywood. They make plywood in 1 meter by 2 meter boards, where we make plywood in 4x8 sheets here. Teven Brothers in Rainier is a big yard there that handles a lot of wood products, like 600-800 truckloads of logs a day. His comment, I called him, was that they have grown from a company up to 120 employees at this time in a short three-year time period, mostly attributed to the growth and increase in timber export. Export business is a key driver of their job growth in Longview area, which is dependent on a good family wage job. His biggest problems that he has to deal with are stormwater management. He's right on the bank of the river, has 30-acre paved slab where their machines work on, and stormwater drainage off of that's a problem to him. Water quality management and air pollution. It gets dusty in the summer, and they have to settle the dust with the water sprinkled on it. The picture there also shows where they're loading lumber on a barge, and they do this continuously, and they'll put 3 to 4 million board feet of lumber on a barge there, and in 5 days it's in Los Angeles and gets unloaded there. That takes about 35 train cars to haul that same amount of lumber if it goes by train. Then another company, Vanport Group from Boring, does practically all their businesses exporting lumber, finished lumber product. They contract with the sawmill at Warm Springs and a sawmill at Boring to manufacture specified products that goes into Japan and China and into Europe. They have 300 employees that are working manufacturing those products. They do almost totally export lumber, finished lumber products. They've cut special beams, mortise and joints on them, special dimensions for those markets. Both of these companies will follow up with written testimony. Any questions?
Well, thank you very much for that, and we'll save questions until we've heard from, let's see, Mr. Polyak.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to talk to you guys. I'm Adrian Polyak, president and part owner of Sam Medical Products. We're located in Wilsonville. It's a 27-year-old company that is a producer of medical technology, medical devices that are essentially life-saving, in addition to products that are injury-preventing and, in some cases, treatment products that run from fracture management items such as splints and pelvic immobilization devices to hemostatic agents, which are used for severe bleeding, to dressings for tension pneumothorax, open chest wounds, as well as dressings for pressure ulcer prevention, bed sore prevention and treatment. Most of our products are used in the battlefield. They're used by emergency medical services, by emergency departments around the world. Our exports actually are now 30% of our total revenue. 3 years ago in 2008, they were 18%. Now they're 30%, which represents about almost a doubling of our growth in just 3 years. We have always placed a premium on exporting around the world. We've spent a lot of years in Europe in particular, but over the past 4 or 5 years, our strategy has been to grow our sales into Asia, including China, as well as to Australia, South Africa, and more recently into South America. Our company essentially is a developer of our technology as well, so we own a lot of intellectual property. We have 30 patents that are both either issued or pending. We have numerous trademarks around the world, and our our emphasis is really to maximize our brand so that our distributors, which is how we primarily sell through, are loyal to our brand and to our products, and try and minimize competition from entering into our space. We do have a number of issues, and then I do have three recommendations to the committee. Our issues really are that we see a lot of trademark violation, copyright violation that occur primarily from China. All but one of our products are still actively under patent protection. We have our flagship product, the SAM splint, which is a portable, moldable splint used by the White House, the shuttle, you name it. It's the most widely used splint in the world. And that patent expired about 11 years ago. And as a result, we've seen a lot of Chinese manufacturers private label for European companies, for U.S. companies, and we see quite a bit of trademark and copyright violation. In addition, we've also seen the cost of export from the U.S. be an issue. I mean, we produce 80% of our products in our Wilsonville facility. We just brought in one of our products, a pelvic sling device, from out of state, from a contractor, back into our facility just a month ago, 3 weeks ago. And that's our goal. We practice lean manufacturing. We've been an ardent sort of advocate, if you will, of producing it under our own roof. We have control over the quality. We have control over the product mix. It's the way to go. But at the same time, our industry partners, if you will, even our competition, often question us why we're producing in the U.S. and why we're producing under our own roof. It's just almost perplexing to them. I just had a visitor this morning come into our facility almost puzzled why we were not producing in China. And you got to bear in mind that we're producing over a million units of products a year. So in many of these products, especially the SAM splint, is something that's ripe for mass production in China. But we ourselves feel that producing in the U.S. Is the right thing to do. Yes, it's more expensive, but we can control the quality, we can control the yields, we can change from one line to another line very quickly. The bigger issue is really that for us to export to Europe or to export to Asia is far more costly than for countries to essentially import into the U.S. There's really a trade cost imbalance that's very, very challenging. So for a German company, for example, to purchase orthopedic splints from a Chinese manufacturer is far less costly, not just in the unit costs, but in the excise tariff costs, versus having SAM Medical ship to Europe, to that German company. It's a very difficult challenge for us, and we've still managed to keep our ground and maintain our market share simply based on brand and quality, not necessarily price. That's a big challenge for us. So my three recommendations or suggestions for change that would help a company like us here in Oregon, who want to stay in this state, who want to manufacture in the state and increase our workforce, is to come up with some type of a tax break or a financial incentive to an exporter like ourselves, or some type of incentive that just levels the playing field so that we as an Oregon exporter have a slightly better chance of competing against a Chinese or Taiwanese or wherever it might be, Indian manufacturer who supplies products that compete with us back to the U.S. or to Europe and other markets that are strong for these products. The second point is some type of a manufacturing grant or a manufacturing incentive which allows a company like us to actually manufacture in-house, which is expensive. I mean, capital equipment is not a small deal. A number of our dressings are manufactured outside of Oregon because of the expensive capital equipment costs involved and the technical know-how of how to run and operate those machines. We would like nothing more than to bring that back into Oregon, but some of those costs are prohibitive. Having some type of financial grant or assistance would make that decision more favorable, more easy to make. And then the third item, which I alluded to, is really workforce expertise. It's very difficult as a medtech medical device manufacturer here in the state to readily find personnel, workforce, not only for the manufacturing floor, but also for marketing, sales, and business development. It's very difficult as a sector. There are other states such as Minnesota, California, Texas, Florida, that have a more of a thriving biotech sector than us, and it's difficult to attract folks to this state, either based on wage affordability or just depth of talent. So those are my three recommendations.
And thank you for those. And we have a question from Representative Lindsay.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was great testimony. I'm going to ask a question and run pretty quickly. I've got another appointment to get to. But when you said level the playing field, my gut reaction was that because your costs are higher than others, unless your margins are slimmer, you still have the quality. But also my gut reaction is that those costs are likely regulation, likely higher taxes, likely, that's just kind of my knee-jerk reaction. Am I right? Am I wrong? Can you drill down and explain what your additional costs are?
Certainly. No, that's a good question, and I appreciate the opportunity to clarify. When I say level the playing field, what I'm really referring to is the actual cost of exporting, not necessarily manufacturing. Our cost of goods, our manufacturing costs to produce that product, yes, they are more expensive than you'd find, let's say, with a manufacturer in China or somewhere else in Asia. That's just the reality of it. It's not going to change. But there is a cost to export. For a Chinese company to export to the U.S., or certainly for a Chinese company to export elsewhere around the world, to Europe, Australia, and so forth, which does occur in our industry quite extensively, is less costly than a U.S. company out of Oregon to export to those same locations. For example, to bring a product into Europe is roughly between 8 to 12% of that product cost when you look at excise duties and so forth. It is less than that for a Chinese manufacturer to export to Europe. So right away, not only are they getting a better price, they're also getting a lower cost to import that product into that company. So we're really being hit twice, if you will. So all I'm saying is that we're doing our utmost right now in Wilsonville to reduce our manufacturing costs. We practice lean manufacturing like it's a religion, and our costs have come down dramatically. Our margins have improved, but you get to a point where there's only so much you can do. Now we've got to export the products. It would be much more favorable for us to go and produce outside of the U.S., and just for simply exporting on parity with companies that are also exporters outside of the U.S., if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
Well, I think the definition of cost of export is, I think, what we're seeking. The cost of export, is that the excise tax you pay when you enter another country? Is it the cost of freight? Are we imposing some sort of tax when you leave? What is that subset of cost of export?
You know, I really believe, and I suspect it's far more than what Oregon can do, but it's essentially the tariffs that I believe those countries are levying on importers from the U.S. I mean, you look at Brazil or Argentina, it's unbelievable. It's close to 100% in certain cases. We have three or four distributors in South America who know our products can be used by ambulance services, by the military, for example, and they just simply cannot bring it in. I mean, they will literally want to bring products in their suitcases back with them because of the futile, excise tax costs. It's just tremendously imbalanced. So we've actually looked at countries like Uruguay and others that do give the ability for a U.S. manufacturer who sets up a plant in Uruguay to be able to sell then without these tariffs in the South American network of countries. These are some of the things we're looking at, not terribly seriously, but you're almost forced to have to entertain those.
Right. Dan, the question, how much more money do you make exporting a log than you do having it milled here in the States?
Very little more. Last April, those pictures there, those logs, we were getting about $300 a truckload more by selling the logs at Longview. Net, after you paid the extra freight and everything to get there, we were netting about $300 a load more. Out of the Longview Harbor, Longview, Tacoma, there's about 12 to 15 ships a month that are shipped going to Japan and China and Korea. So it's significant business. It's a lot of material.
But the price differential is fairly modest.
It's not huge. It's not huge.
Representative Wagner.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, on the same thing, do you know the percentage difference between finished product, wood products that we send, so plywood or it'd be metric, that we send versus whole logs over to the
percentage of finished product?
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Now, out of Canada, it's a bigger percentage of finished material and a smaller percentage of raw logs. Out of here, Oregon and Washington, it's a bigger percentage of raw logs than it is finished lumber. Yeah.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm really intrigued. I just happened to be talking with Senator Merkley last night about the whole issue of, you know, we have these trade agreements that have been set up with countries, and in a lot of cases, they are not being enforced. You know, the trade agreement may be just fine, but the WTO is not requiring the kind of information about what the tariffs that are being imposed by other countries actually are. I would really encourage you to pass along your specific information to Senator Merkley's office, because I think he sounded like he was in the process of putting together some bipartisan legislation to go after those kind of, first of all, disclosing those tariffs that other countries are imposing on some exports from the U.S. But I'm also interested in the two of you. Mr. Decker talked specifically about kind of the route by which his products go. Are all of your, for the other two of you, are your products all going by ship? Are you doing some exports by air? Can you maybe just talk about where your products, the mode by which your products are being exported?
Our products are predominantly by ship because of the size and weight issues. We do occasionally air on some of our smaller stuff, and sometimes when it's even on some of the larger stuff when it's a time critical, but predominantly by ship.
Out of the Port of Portland?
Yeah.
And also by ship, but equally by air freight. So it's about 50-50. They're fairly light products.
Yeah.
Small.
Out of Port of Portland and PDX?
It's mostly through the carriers, FedEx, UPS, and so forth. So that's
on the air side?
Most likely PDX, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And on the ship side through Port of Portland?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
And then the lumber log products are all shipped, mostly at Longview,
right.
Some at Astoria, some at Coos Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions for this panel? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We really appreciate your patience and your testimony. It's very, very helpful. And with that, committee members, unless there's anything further, that exhausts our list now that we've refined it.
Did you already get these two?
Yes, I put off Gary Roth and Todd Davidson until and they know, right. And Scott Drum, right.
You'd think I'd have heard you say that.
I don't think you were
here. No, I wasn't here. That's right. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to adjourn. Thank you.
Again.